This is Dr. Richard Verrone, and I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Charles Ty Dodge. Today is July 18th, 2003. It is approximately 9:47 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University, in the Special Collections Library interview room. Mr. Dodge, you're in Birmingham, Alabama. And why don't we start with some biographical information on yourself, sir? Tell me when and where you were born and a little bit about growing up.
Okay. Born in Temple, Texas, mm-hmm. on April 28th of 1945, which my mom always reminded me was False VE Day, Europe Day.
Uh-huh.
We lived there about 18 months. My dad was in Europe, and after about 18 months, we headed over to Germany right after the war, actually to Austria. And being an Army brat, spent most of my life traveling around. I hit 12 schools by the time I was in high school.
Hmm.
And we spent about 6 years in Europe, two different tours with Dad
mm-hmm.
over there.
How did the traveling affect you? Was that hard on you as a child growing up?
You know, it's interesting. I tend to be sort of not an extrovert, more of an introvert.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I think traveling and meeting new people kind of forced me out of my shell.
Mm-hmm.
And I really liked it. It was probably hardest during the early high school years. I think that's when kids get attached to friends and home and
mm-hmm.
what have you.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess we just got used to it after a while.
Right.
And looking back, it's a great experience. Although I'm glad to have some roots now.
Mm-hmm. How long were you in Temple?
Only 18 months, other than when I went, one of my duty stations in the Army was at Fort Hood, so
okay.
I was there about 6 months.
Okay. When you think about your childhood, where do you see? Do you see a particular place?
I guess the places that I remember most would be Germany experiences
mm-hmm.
and a lot of time in Virginia in the Washington, D.C. area.
Okay. Tell me about Germany. When were you over there? How old were you?
The first time, I was 18 months to 4 years.
Okay.
We were in Austria most of that time in Vienna.
Mm-hmm.
I remember... Of course, being young, I remember a German maid that
mm-hmm.
Kind of took care of me.
Mm-hmm.
I had an older sister who was 5 years older. I can kind of remember things that we did. And, in fact, my wife and I went back to Germany in 1991 and visited those places, and they came back to me.
Hmm.
But the stories that my mom would tell me, Dad was involved in the sort of Reconstruction government aspects of Germany. And
mm-hmm.
we would get a lot. We lived in German housing
mm-hmm.
just on the economy, and we would often get threats against our various lives. And Mom would tell me about Ia, my maid, taking me out on walks, and there would be CID guys dressed as plumbers and electricians and what have you all along the way, kind of keeping watch.
Hmm. Interesting.
So that was my very early time.
Mm-hmm.
We were again in Germany in the mid 50s in Baumholder in Stuttgart.
Mm-hmm.
And, a lot of fond memories of that as well.
You said you had a sister. Any other siblings?
No, just one.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Tell me about your parents. Tell me about your dad and his job and what he did.
Dad was grew up in the Northeast, born in New Jersey, and
mm-hmm.
kind of raised in Vermont. Was a 1930 graduate of the United States Military Academy
mm-hmm.
and chose cavalry as his combat arm.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of started his career at Fort Riley. At the cavalry school, and he was a diehard in-the-wool saber-swinging cavalryman to the end. In fact, he retired a lieutenant general, and in the early 60s, he was
mm-hmm.
Commanded the 1st Cavalry Division in Korea.
Hmm.
And I recall that he required that all of his officers put whatever their branch insignia was on top of cross sabers.
Hmm. Okay.
He was kind of non-reg, but he was a kind of a non-reg guy at times.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting guy, though, but loved the combat arms
mm-hmm.
and always thought of himself as a soldier in the foxhole.
Mm-hmm.
Fairly demanding, as you might expect.
Mm-hmm.
Great guy.
How about your mother?
My mom was San Franciscan.
Okay.
Kind of had the pioneer spirit. Her dad was an Australian Episcopal minister, and
okay.
he was killed when she was about 10, maybe. They had gotten a new automotive fire engine in Oakland, and several people from around dignitaries and whatever were invited to ride on it, and he and several others were riding on it on one of those first rides, and
mm-hmm.
it it slipped off the side of the road and pinned him against a tree, and he eventually died. So my mom and her two sisters grew up in an all-female household in Palo Alto.
Okay.
And mom, I think, kind of assumed the role of dad in the family. She was the middle daughter. But she had a very adventurous spirit, was a great storyteller. I can remember going on trips with her, for example, the battlefields around the East, and she could make a Civil War battlefield absolutely come alive.
Really?
Yeah.
That's neat.
In fact, it drove her crazy in Germany. My sister would always sleep when we went on vacation. It drove my mom nuts.
Well, I can imagine that your father was a great influence upon you joining the military. Was that so?
Well, he was, and yet never in a way that he expected it.
Really?
Didn't expect me to go to West Point. Didn't expect me to go in the military. He kind of told me the positives and the negatives about military life. But as I grew up, I just kind of assumed that I would do what Dad did. So I planned on a military career.
You did?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. From how young did you plan this? Do you remember?
You know, in terms of actual planning, probably not until late high school, though I can't ever really remember myself thinking about being in any other kind of an occupation. I was just, military was so ingrained, I just assumed that's what everybody did.
Well, you grew up around it.
Yeah.
And in it, basically.
Interestingly enough, we live very infrequently on a military post.
Okay.
All but one of the 6 years in Germany, for 5 years, we lived on the economy. And even in the States, we tended not to live on the post. So we were around a lot of civilians, but had military influence as well.
Right. Okay. Tell me about your jobs you had as a youth. What did you do? Did you work a lot, or were you not?
A fair amount. In about middle of high school, I started working at an SO station, back when they had SO stations. In my senior year of high school, I was at a boarding school and didn't have the opportunity to work. My first year at Virginia, I was school, summer and winter and everything. And as I mentioned, with all the knowledge of a 19-year-old, eloped my second year at Virginia. And then I had to find a co-ed school. And so this was my first wife. We ended up at Furman. At Furman, his mom and dad agreed to pay my college expense, but everything else was my problem now.
Okay.
And so I worked at the post office and in the summers did construction work.
Okay. What kind of student were you growing up?
I was an awful student until my senior year in high school, which is when mom and dad sent me to the Bullis School in Silver Spring, Maryland, which was an all-male boarding school, kind of an Annapolis prep school. And the regimen there, I did pretty well there. Got to Virginia, and I was in the civil engineering program in Virginia, and I really don't have a background's not the right word, but I don't have a mathematical bone in my body. And yet, mom and dad had always told me I was good at fixing things and making things and what have you, so I assumed I needed to be an engineer.
Okay.
And really didn't like that. I ended up with a sociology major at Furman.
Okay. What do you remember as your favorite subjects then, if you weren't good or didn't like math?
I tended not to like subjects that I had to memorize. For example, history was always hard for me. I liked geometry because I could figure out geometry. I didn't have to memorize anything. Tended to like English, but I liked sociology courses, psychology courses, that sort of thing.
Okay. And you said you went to the University of Virginia. Was that by choice? Was it expected that you would go into college, or did you have a desire to go in?
I don't think that I ever thought anything else. It was just kind of, you know, one of those what you did sort of things. And we happened to be residents of Virginia at the time, so that was a kind of a natural match.
Okay. What year did you graduate high school?
Graduated in 63.
Okay. And you entered in the fall of 63 to the UVA?
Right. Yeah.
Okay. And you lasted 1 year, is that right?
Yeah, a year and a half.
Okay. Now, why just a year and a half there at UVA?
I eloped right at the end of my first semester of my second year, and then found myself being married in an all-male school. My wife was going to Radford at the time down in the southwestern corner of Virginia.
Yes.
We had to find a school that would accommodate both of us. Plus the fact frankly, my grades were awful in the engineering program at Virginia.
What was the influence of your father upon your grades and your schooling? How was he reacting to this?
You know, it's interesting. Dad was, I would put him in the workaholic category,
mm-hmm.
and we never really had a lot of time together growing up.
Mm-hmm.
We did more in his later years than when I was young,
mm-hmm.
and he was sort of the stern taskmaster, but he wasn't around much.
Right.
I think maybe Mom was a greater influence on my life in that way.
Okay.
As I think about motivation in the two of them, I would jump over a tall building for Dad because I was afraid not to,
mm-hmm.
and I'd jump over a tall building for Mom because she made me want to.
Okay.
So they were totally different in the way they motivated.
Okay. So when you went down to Furman, you ended up graduating, is that right?
Right.
What year did you graduate?
Graduated in 68.
Okay. Tell me, you know, between 63 and 68, this is when the United States was really heavily getting involved in Southeast Asia.
Right.
What did you know about that involvement?
You know, interesting, at Virginia, I don't think I was too in tune to that, even though I was in the ROTC program.
Mm-hmm.
At Furman, being married and spending more time at home watching television occasionally,
mm-hmm.
Not in a dorm room, we, of course, began watching Vietnam unfold on the TV.
Right.
And so I would watch that, but I'm not sure that I was that in tune to the big picture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I kind of saw what was happening on the ground. But other than the fact that my dad always impressed on me that whether we were obligated to go to Vietnam, he couldn't answer that question. But he thought that our cause was just, that
mm-hmm.
there was a people that was being overtaken by communism and losing their freedom, and
mm-hmm.
so he felt it was a good cause.
Okay.
And that, I think, led over to me.
Were you, at this point in your career, thinking, okay, I'm definitely going to be in a war very shortly, or were you thinking, I might be able to not get involved in that?
Well, having my eyes set on a military career,
right.
As it turned out, when I got to Furman and being married, I kind of settled down, so my grades got pretty good. I ended up being a distinguished military graduate,
mm-hmm.
and I could pick my branch
mm-hmm.
and my first duty assignment.
So you did ROTC at Furman?
Yeah.
Okay.
I ended up picking armor as my branch, and we were able to select duty assignments, and I picked Germany. This was about a year before I graduated,
mm-hmm.
so a little less. And as I got to thinking about that, it seemed that if I were going to make a career of it, Germany wasn't the place to start. Vietnam was the place to start, so I had my orders changed. So
mm-hmm.
it was purely voluntary, which may have a lot to do with attitude. You know, a lot of guys struggle with Vietnam
mm-hmm.
because they were pulled over there on a chain. They didn't really want to go. And yet, that was my career, so my outlook's probably different than some.
So you changed from going to Germany to actually wanting to go to Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about how that happened inside you? I mean, you're going, okay, I can be safe pretty much in Central Europe versus go right into a war zone.
I guess part of the good news is I was 22 years old, and
mm-hmm.
nobody dies when you're 22.
Right.
We're all bulletproof.
Mm-hmm.
So while obviously I saw the risk and some people that I knew being killed, that wasn't going to happen to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I did have a career that I had to consider, and that
mm-hmm.
was, from a career standpoint, the best way to get real experience.
Yes.
For what the Army needed.
Yes. Tell me about your ROTC training. What was that like?
I kind of enjoyed it. It was sort of a natural, just because I'd been in a military family.
Mm-hmm.
The regiment and all that hoopla, you know, I really liked that.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed the subjects we studied. And oddly enough, some of the military customs I find a little strange.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they're necessary to keep a family that big sort of cohesive as they move around from place to place, some
mm-hmm.
of that regiment.
Can you give me an example?
Yeah, like things like when you go to a new post visiting the your commanding officer and the, I can't remember the exact thing, but, you know, leaving two business cards in the silver tray, all that stuff seems
mm-hmm.
kind of weird to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess it was the regiment that kind of made you feel a fit
mm-hmm.
because you knew what was going to happen.
Right.
No matter where you were. So I enjoy the ROTC program.
Okay. And you adapted to that military discipline, the military lifestyle, okay?
Yeah, I did.
Is that mainly because you'd grown up around it and in it?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Okay. So when you finished at Furman, where did you go? What happened?
First duty station right out of Furman, I went to Fort Jackson, South Carolina as
okay.
a training officer.
Okay.
sort of a, got to put this guy someplace before we can get him into school deal. Mm-hmm. And I was the training officer and the mess officer and, you know, all the duties that new a second lieutenant has.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting experience, though, and I learned a lot from the NCOs that were on the staff there.
Mm-hmm.
Really taught me a lot. And I had one interesting experience that I didn't really know how it was going to play out. We had one guy that was he really was a troublemaker.
Mm-hmm.
And I, for some reason, decided to take him under my wing and see if I could turn him around. We eventually got him through basic training. And a couple of years later, I was commanding a convoy in Vietnam, and we stopped along the road and met another convoy coming south, and
mm-hmm.
the lieutenant with that convoy said, "Hey, you're Lieutenant Dodge." And I said, "Yeah," and it turned out to be that guy.
Really?
Yeah. And he commented that he'd appreciated kind of the discipline of basic training and
mm-hmm.
my interest in him.
Mm-hmm. Tell me what your duties were as training officer.
You know, it's interesting being a new second lieutenant with some good NCOs around. They
mm-hmm.
were the guys that really ran the show,
mm-hmm.
even though I was supposed to look like I was doing something. But I would do things like be the duty officer on the grenade range.
Mm-hmm.
We would do a lot of things with the training company, marches and training exercises, one thing and another. I did have a responsibility for the NCOs in my training company,
mm-hmm.
though, again, they really were the ones that ran the ship.
Right.
And then I had a lot of miscellaneous duties, like mess officer, and I can't even remember. I probably had five or six of those other odd jobs that
mm-hmm.
the lieutenant gets.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did
I remember one real interesting experience, because I thought I was pretty put together, and I was. I was pretty polished and buttoned up and
mm-hmm.
starched and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I arrived on my first day with the training company there at Fort Jackson.
Mm-hmm. This is, again, in 1968 or 69?
68, yeah.
68, okay.
Yeah. Summer of 68, and Buck Sergeant, who was one of the NCOs there,
mm-hmm.
walked up to me and said, "Lieutenant John Dodge, you look pretty good." And I thought, "Yeah, I do." And I was dark, polished and all that. And
mm-hmm.
he said, "Your boots look good." And I said, "Yeah, I spent a lot of time shining them last night." And he looked down at him and he said, "But, sir, did you shine the tongue?" I had to confess I had not shined the tongue.
Uh-huh.
And that got my attention.
Right.
Attention to detail. It's what
right.
keeps people alive in the Army.
Right. Well, let's back up just a minute back to Furman. Did you go one summer to kind of a basic training?
I did. We went to Fort Bragg.
Okay.
And
tell me what that experience was like for you.
You know, I mentioned before, I'm sort of an introvert. I
mm-hmm.
tended to wrestle with feeling good about myself
mm-hmm.
and having a lot of confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And I played a lot of sports, but I was not a jock by any means.
Mm-hmm.
I played lacrosse and some other stuff like that. But, I always had a fear, and maybe it was because my dad expected a lot, I always had a fear that I wasn't going to be successful.
Really?
Yeah.
In general in life or just at certain things?
Still to this day, it still kind of haunts me.
Huh.
Yeah. And so as I got into training programs like summer camp at Fort Bragg,
mm-hmm.
where there's a lot of harassment,
mm-hmm.
My greatest fear was not being able to cut it, but it turned out okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was able to do it okay, and I remember things like the bayonet course. I loved the bayonet course, and we did the 34-foot tower, the jump tower,
mm-hmm.
some stuff like that.
Were you motivated by this fear, or did it more paralyze you at times?
I think I was motivated by it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you share this with your father or your mother?
Never did.
Huh.
Never did.
And you say you still have that today?
Yeah.
To a point?
Yeah.
Where do you think that comes from?
I think it may come from the fact that, and I'm speculating here,
mm-hmm.
but Dad was the kind of guy that expected you to jump before he told you to jump
uh-huh.
and get it right the first time and never make a mistake kind of thing. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, we make mistakes. And I guess I was always trying to live up to that expectation of my dad, realizing that I could never be perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted perfect. And it's really kind of funny because he's a loving guy. When you really messed up, he didn't rub it in because
mm-hmm.
he knew that you'd rub it in yourself.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, he was very rigid about a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's where I got it.
Okay.
Other than that, just general personality trait.
Okay. Okay. So back at Fort Jackson, how did you relate to the younger men that you were training and overseeing?
probably more compassionately than my NCOs did, because, again, that's kind of my nature. I thought some of the things we did, we overdid it. We would send the disciplinary guys problems down to near a river, and they'd carry big logs through the sand, you know, do all that stuff. Accomplished the purpose. It seemed like overdoing it to me, but I can see now that what they were trying to accomplish, how it actually did work in some cases.
Right.
I felt a real compassion for the Puerto Ricans that were in the training.
Why?
Because a lot of them didn't speak great English, and, man, the NCOs would get all over them about that. Really, they'd give them a hard time. And, of course, my training NCOs thought they were putting on so that they could shirk their duties or slack off. I didn't believe that, but anyway, I kind of had a compassionate view toward them. And though I think I pushed them pretty hard, realizing that we were in the middle of a war, and that's where you started learning how to survive it.
Right. Did any of the people above you, had they had experience in Southeast Asia?
You know, it's funny. I don't remember anybody above me at all at Fort Jackson other than one major who chewed me out for something, and I can't remember even what it was he chewed me out for. But I don't think he was in my immediate chain of command.
Okay. The men that you were training, did they know they were going to Southeast Asia?
Yeah, I think they had a pretty good idea.
Yeah. Okay. And how about yourself? Did you have an idea that you would be over there shortly, or did you have a choice of not to go over?
Yeah, because I already had orders.
You did?
Yeah, having requested it at Furman.
Right.
I actually had, I guess they weren't specific date at that point, but I was on the list to go as soon as I got through my training.
Okay. Your training, what training was that?
Most of the stuff that I did Ranger School in the fall of 68.
Okay.
I did Armor Officer Basic in the fall of 68 at Fort Knox.
Okay.
And then in the spring of, or late winter, I guess, of early part of 69, I went to Jungle School in Panama.
Okay.
And that was during my last duty station before going to Vietnam. I was stationed in Fort Hood for about 6 months.
Okay.
And I went to Panama during that time.
Okay. Let's go back. Tell me about Ranger training. What was that like?
Scared me to death.
Yeah?
Yeah. Learned a lot. Learned a lot about myself. Kind of interesting. We had Ranger's all about teamwork. Everything's done with a buddy. You never leave your buddy behind. The first day, of course, Rangers spent a lot of time in the water, and the first day they double-timed the 3rd Ranger Company over to one of the pools at Fort Benning for our swimming test. And we had on our fatigues and boots and stuff. Lined us up in front of the ladder at the high dive, and, of course, we weren't supposed to say anything, look at anybody anywhere but straight ahead, all that Ranger stuff. And the guy, one of the Ranger instructors, got up and read us the rules. He said, what we're going to do is we're going to put a 45-pound pack on you, give you an M1 rifle, blindfold you, walk you up to the top of the ladder, walk you out to the end of the board, and then tell you to step off. The rules are, when you get in the water, you can drop your pack, but you may never, ever leave your rifle. Number two, if you have to be fished out of the pool, you fail. And if you drown, you fail. And that's a big confidence builder. So I'm about 8 or 9 guys back from the ladder, I guess, and standing next to me was a young Blackfeet lieutenant named Reginald White. First time I'd ever seen him. And Reggie turned to me. Of course, we weren't supposed to be talking. He turned to me and said, Ty, I can't swim. And I said, man, Reg, you got to get out of this line. He said, no way, man, I'm going to get the tab. You know, we were really there for two reasons. One was to get the Ranger tab. And the other was to learn how to survive. And I'm not sure which was more important, probably the tab. So anyway, Reggie stayed in line. I figured, well, it's his call. So he got to the ladder, and they blindfolded him, did all the stuff, took him to the top, and he walked out to the end of the board and walked off. And somehow he made it to the side. And the thing that impressed me about Reggie was that during our Ranger training, Reggie taught us how to work as a team. And I guess that's maybe the biggest thing that I got out of, other than just a lot of self-confidence.
How did he teach you to work as a team?
I don't know. He was one of those guys that was always positive. And when one guy was down, he would figure out a way to get him up. you know, if one guy couldn't carry his pack anymore, somebody else carried it. Maybe mm-hmm. Reggie encouraged you to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But he was just one of those great team builders.
Okay. Okay. Anything else at your Ranger training? Just, did you say you went to jump school as well?
No, I didn't do jump school.
Okay. What other kind of training did you have besides the jungle school?
I had armor officer basic training.
What was that like?
It was at Fort Knox, mm-hmm. and we did packed an awful lot in on weapons, vehicles, tactics, mm-hmm. one thing and another.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so much that you spent so little time on any topic, I'm not sure we ever learned any of it very well.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that we didn't really train on was cavalry tactics. And of course, that's what I ended up in Vietnam.
Right. Why not?
I don't know. I think they just didn't have time to pack it in.
Okay.
But I think the cavalry tactics we had in Vietnam were so different than typical cavalry anyway that it wouldn't have made a lot of difference.
Mm-hmm. The training that you received at Armor Officer Basic, was that focused on what you would be doing in Southeast Asia, or was it just general?
I would say, I'm not sure I could say it was 50-50, but it was both.
Okay.
Because a lot of it just dealt with equipment and tactics you would use anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, a lot of the guys there had some Vietnam experience, and so that was sort of their focus,
mm-hmm.
was to get you ready for Vietnam.
Right. Okay. What were they telling you? Do you remember what they were telling you about Vietnam?
You know, I don't, other than I can recall, for example, learning about booby traps and,
mm-hmm.
and anti-tank mines and stuff, and the NCOs really impressing on you that it could be you that's going to go down with one of these.
Mm-hmm.
And being very rigid about that.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel about the fact that you knew you were going over there?
Actually, you know, scared but excited at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
I anticipated it in a positive way.
Mm-hmm. How about your wife?
She was, we had a small child at the time.
Okay.
A young son who was born in 68, or 69, rather. And she grew up as an Air Force brat. So she understood where I was coming from,
mm-hmm.
but she was not at all excited about my going.
Okay.
And as I look back on it now, I can appreciate that a lot better. I didn't appreciate it very well then.
Mm-hmm. How about your parents?
Mom and Dad were okay with it. You know, Dad, they were both kind of realists,
mm-hmm.
and realized that this was part of the military.
Mm-hmm.
If you were going to be in the military, you had to expect to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Becky's mom and dad, they were probably not as excited about it as my mom and dad were, but they were very supportive of it.
Okay.
In fact, I talked to her dad about it at some length,
mm-hmm.
before I made the decision to have my orders changed.
Really?
Yeah, he pretty much said, you know, you got to do what you got to do, and you're making a career of it. So.
Okay. So he was pro you going over to Southeast Asia?
Yeah, at least positive, yeah.
Okay. Tell me about jungle school in Panama. What was that like?
It was 2 weeks, as I recall, two
mm-hmm.
or 3 weeks. Most of which we spent in the jungle.
Okay.
And pretty good prep for Vietnam, I think. I was in the Central Highlands in Vietnam, which
mm-hmm.
is a little bit hilly. And the jungle in Panama, where we were, was all mountains,
mm-hmm.
so it was all up and down and a lot of rain.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of learning to make do in an adverse environment.
Mm-hmm.
I don't recall that I learned an awful lot about tactics, but it was a long time ago. I probably did.
Mm-hmm.
Did some fun things, like we had a slide for life that they built across the Chagres River,
mm-hmm.
From a cliff on the other side. We had to wrap all of our gear in a poncho to make a raft, swim it across the river. Then we'd climb up this cliff. I don't know how high we were, maybe 80 feet. And there was a tower up there that on a little ledge.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing that they would do before they put you on the slide for life was they made you dip your pulley in oil. I don't know if that really made it go faster, but in
mm-hmm.
your mind, it seemed like
right.
You were going to. Then we'd take the zip line across the Chagres River. That was one of my big memories. And rappelling off a waterfall.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of fun.
What kind of weapons training did you have?
We trained a little bit on the M16, but
mm-hmm.
not very much, and that was at Fort Knox.
Mm-hmm.
Most of what we carried were M1s, and really didn't have a lot of training per se on those.
Mm-hmm.
At Fort Knox, we did a lot of machine gun training, M60 and 50 caliber,
mm-hmm.
and then tanks. And of course, they didn't really have armored personnel carriers configured as an ACAB the way we did in Vietnam with
mm-hmm.
the three machine guns. But did some of that sort of thing as well.
Okay. Did you feel prepared to go over to war?
You know, I think I felt as prepared as I could be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really did.
Okay. Did you have some leave time before you went over?
Very little, as I recall. I finished up my jungle school training was in the middle of my Fort Knox assignment.
Mm-hmm.
I came back, finished out Fort Knox. I probably had a week or so maybe before I left.
Hmm. Okay. Where did you leave from? From the West Coast?
Left from Birmingham, then went to Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I left from there. Well, Travis Airport. Is that Travis out there, I think?
Yes.
Yeah.
Did you fly civilian air or military?
I flew Pan Am jet with movies and good-looking stewardesses. And I found it interesting. At each refueling stop, the stewardesses would get older, and I think that's because they had more time and grade, and they got combat pay when they got closer to Vietnam.
Right.
They were great, though. The odd thing about it was flying into Saigon, and the pilot kind of banked around, and I'm expecting rockets,
mm-hmm.
tracers to be coming up by the windows, and the pilot comes on the intercom. He says, if you look out the window, you can see the whatever river it was down there.
Mm-hmm.
He said, we hope you had a pleasant flight, and we'll fly with us again soon. I thought that was kind of funny.
Right. What was the mood on the airplane? Do you remember?
I really don't. I remember more of the mood on the plane going, where were we going? Maybe flying out to Travis.
Mm-hmm.
That one there. Yeah, I was probably flying out to Travis. I was one of the few officers on that flight.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of enlisted guys were probably draftees, mm-hmm. just petrified of going over there.
Were you in uniform?
Yeah.
Okay. And do you remember them looking up to you or kind of being standoffish?
Probably neither.
Okay.
Just kind of neither one.
Okay. All right. You're going over there as an officer. You're going to lead a platoon.
Right.
How do you feel? How did you see yourself? Were you prepared to be a leader in that capacity?
You know, I think having been through the training that I've been through and having been through my dad's training over the years, I felt pretty prepared.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. What would you say were your best qualities as a leader at that point?
I had gotten to the point in life where I would go to the max to get it done,
mm-hmm.
whether that were physically or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I had a strong inclination that, as far as my superiors were concerned, I would share with them my opinion as strongly as I needed to, but when they told me to take the hill, we'd go take the hill.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I had an awful lot of compassion for my men, which I think a lot of the platoon leaders and NCOs over there did have,
mm-hmm.
maybe because it was an unpopular war. We were there for 13 months. Part of the deal was to survive 13 months and get home.
Mm-hmm.
And we took care of each other.
Mm-hmm.
Someone made the comment, we weren't fighting the war for America. We were fighting for each other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot of truth in that. I mean.
Now, at that point, the anti-war movement at home is in full swing.
It really kind of is.
Yeah. Yeah. How did that affect you?
I think it irritated me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I couldn't understand. You know, I was so pro what we were doing. If mm-hmm. America was doing it, it had to be right. I couldn't understand why anybody would protest against that.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty parochial view. But it did irritate me.
Did you guys talk about it in country?
You know, I don't recall. We spent so much time just grinding out operations, we had very little time to just hang out.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember talking about it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
The other thing that irritated me, and I think it irritated my guys a lot too, was the press.
Really?
The press would swoop in after a battle, mm-hmm. take the pictures, do the interviews, which we thought were just to, you know, record the blood and gore so they'd get a good story,
mm-hmm.
which I know now is not true.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'd fly away, and it really irked a lot of guys.
Really? Was that almost constant? Was that after every firefight, every battle?
No, we didn't see them very often. Occasionally, we had one big deal after a firefight in September, a rather large
mm-hmm.
battle, that they came out with camera crews. And somebody, I can't remember who it was, but it was a pretty famous correspondent,
mm-hmm.
came out and stayed an hour.
Okay. And those were, you said, overall kind of negative experiences?
Yeah, for the most part.
Yeah, okay. What month did you go over in 1969?
Went over in 16, June.
Okay, and you were there for a 13-month tour?
No, I was wounded in November, so I got back out of country.
Okay, so in June 69 you go.
Yeah.
All right. Why don't we take a break just for a moment?
Okay.
Tell me about when you first flew into Saigon, you said. What was your first impression?
You know, a lot of people have the first impressions of the smell, the heat, all that stuff.
Yes, sir.
My first impression was the pilot with his casual comment, "I hope you fly with us again."
Right.
By the friendly skies.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember much about that first week there other than kind of getting processed through and then going, being sent out to Camp Black Horse. But I do remember this, being trained in armor. I wanted to be in armor, and they put me in cavalry, and I thought, oh, my goodness, I don't have a clue what I'm going to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
So that worried me a little bit.
Really?
At any rate, they sent me to Swan Lock, which is where the Black Horse base camp was, the 11th Army camp, where we did a very short orientation, some kind of patrols around the fire base.
What did they tell me about that? How do they prepare you for Vietnamese culture, for the actual fighting? How did they want to acclimate you? How much preparation did you have
in country?
Well,
overall
in general, and specifically in country when you arrived.
I think I got a lot better orientation to that from ranger and jungle school, and some from armor officer basic, because a lot of those guys had been to Vietnam. They related kind of what it was like, and so I got a lot of good feeling there about what it was really going to be like. When we got in country, the few patrols we must have gone out on were so inconsequential that I don't even remember them.
Okay.
So there was very little that I recall in country getting us prepared.
Were you in charge of these patrols, or were you...
No, I was just going along for the ride.
Okay. And were they, say, here, you know, here's how you do this, here's what you can expect?
No, I guess, but I really can't remember them.
Okay. What were those first few days like when you got in country? You were processed in at Saigon.
Yeah.
And where did you go from there?
Processed through Saigon, went to Swan Lock for Black Horse Base Camp.
Okay.
Spent a couple of days there doing that patrolling deal.
Mm-hmm.
I remember meeting I guess he was a second lieutenant. He was a Cobra pilot.
Mm-hmm.
Who I kind of became friends with in those 2 or 3 days that we were there.
Mm-hmm.
He ended up being killed about a month later. He piled his Cobra into the airstrip one night.
Mm.
But it was just kind of a waiting, anxious to get out in the field, get going kind of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, one of my vivid memories of just before going out, I was really ready to get out of base camp and get on with the show, being 24 years old, trained by all the best the Army had to train, you know, bulletproof, ready to get on with it. And the regimental sergeant major came out one day and said, "Lieutenant Dodge, I've got your orders for you." I said, "That's great, Sergeant Major. Tell me where I'm going. I'm anxious to get on out there."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "I'll get you out there soon enough, but first I want you to attend that memorial service over there." And I looked over about 100 yards away, and in this puddle, a chaplain's got some C-ration boxes piled up with a poncho liner on it and a cross sitting on the top. There are a bunch of guys standing around.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Sure, I'd be glad to go to that, but why me? Why that memorial service?"
Mm-hmm.
And he looked me in the eye, and in the way only a regimental sergeant major can do, he said, "Lieutenant, that service is for Lieutenant Pierce. He was your platoon's platoon leader until 2 days ago, got hit in the chest by an RPG, and we only brought half of them home." And then he said, "Don't you ever forget that."
Hmm.
And so I went to the memorial service, and suddenly all this invincibility that I had, I just kind of crumbled down around my feet, and I realized I was getting in something deep here.
Mm-hmm.
But after the memorial service, he said, "Take your gear and put it on that loach over there." And it was late in the afternoon, kind of pouring down rain, and so I went over and stuck my gear on this loach, and pilot took off. I was starting to get real nerves now.
Mm-hmm.
He began flying toward Cambodia. The troop was out about 2 kilometers from the Cambodian border, and we flew out a million thundering heartbeats getting out there.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, driving down rain, he pulls a map out and he pokes his finger down on the map, and he says, "Your troop's right about there." And it was like right on the Cambodian border.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, man, that's Indian country out there.
Mm-hmm.
So we went a little further, and he looked out to the front of the aircraft, and he said, "See that clearing down there?" And I looked, and there was a armored cavalry troop, MDT'd in this clearing. He said, "That's where I'm taking you." So we went and sat down outside the MDT, and I dragged my gear off the loach, and as I was running across the field to get to the MDT, I saw my first funny thing in Vietnam.
What was that?
Pouring down rain, there's a a buck-naked tanker standing on top of an M60 tank, lathering up with soap and rain. I thought that is weird. The first night I had my platoon sergeant was a guy named Sergeant Tom Simski. He was Polish, great guy. And somehow he had a cot that he'd gotten from someplace, and he set it up next to my track, put a poncho liner lean-to, and I thought, gosh, that's really nice of him to do that for me, and I think he did it on purpose. The poncho leaked all night long onto my cot. I never slept on a cot the rest of the time I was there. I was just getting me broken in.
How did the men react to you when you first arrived?
Well, you know, I guess as I expected, they were cordial. They obviously knew I was green as a gourd around the ears. What I didn't know, and I didn't intend for them to know, was that my dad was a lieutenant general, because I figured that didn't hold any water for me.
Where was he stationed at this point?
He was actually retired. He was the executive vice president of the AUSA at that time. But I think it's funny, in meeting my guys over the years, and I've met a number of them recently, kind of reconnected. One guy in particular, a fellow named Mark Prendergast, who is now an editor with the New York Times, I asked him, you know, what did you guys think when this new lieutenant came out? He said, well, frankly, we knew your dad was a lieutenant general, and they were a little wary of you, and it really took to the first good firefight to see how you were going to act before we were going to buy into your program. But they were cordial and, you know, treated me with respect.
What would you say was the morale?
The morale was really good. Really good. We were, you know, if I contrast an Army Cav outfit to an infantry outfit, and I may be being a little unfair to the infantry here, but we stayed in the field literally all the time, unless we happened to go into a fire base at night to secure it for the artillery. We were always in the field, whereas the infantry would go out on an operation and then come back. And I think during that period of time, they were experiencing problems, some racial particularly, where when they would get back to their fire base, they had drugs and they had racial problems, one thing or another. I think they tightened up again once they got out in the field, but still some of that was left. You know, with us, we were always out there, always thinking about the next mine we were going to run over and just looking out for each other. So it was a pretty tight organization.
Did that remain constant your few months
really
there?
Did. Yeah.
Okay. Let me ask you this, overall big picture. What, at that point, and you arrived in country, what did you understand about why the United States was even in South Vietnam? Did you understand that bigger picture, or what did you think about it?
I think my concept then was that South Vietnam was a country that had been taken over against their will by North Vietnam, that they were being forced into a way of life that they didn't really like, didn't want, and that we were the saviors to get them out, that the French couldn't do it, so certainly we could. I think that's about my whole big picture at that time.
Okay. Did you see that as a worthy cause? Did you have a problem with, you know, kind of helping these people defend their country or doing it for them?
I thought it was a great cause, frankly, to be a part of it. We didn't work with South Vietnamese troops other than maybe a week while I was there, so I didn't really get a lot of contact with them. I heard a lot of stories about how they were sort of 9-to-5. You know, they didn't really take the war seriously, which I don't think was true at all, but that's kind of what you heard.
Right.
That was irritating in the sense that here we are risking our lives and you guys aren't pulling your share, which, again, somewhat of a misconception. The other aspect of it that I found from the compassionate side was that the people we met out in the country just seemed like, you know, they were for the VC at night and they were for the Americans in the daytime. They were caught in the middle. And what they really wanted to do was let the war go away and let me keep growing my rice. You know, get out of my hair here. And so that was a real tender issue for me.
You said you worked with the South Vietnamese military just for about a week. Was this the Arvin?
Yeah, the Arvin. I had an Arvin infantry platoon riding with my platoon.
Okay. What was your impression of them?
They seemed to be pretty good. We didn't do much during that week in terms of no action at all. I did have one kind of interesting experience. The platoon leader, he and I couldn't communicate very well, but he spoke some English. He was riding on my track, and we'd set up an NDP in a sort of a swamp, as I recall, and he invited me to dinner. Of course, invited me on my own track to dinner, but he Right. Indigenous stuff, and their sea rations were different from ours. They were really indigenous. He sent his guys out into the woods to cut young, fresh bamboo shoots and stuff like that. It was a good meal. Had a little soy sauce. Fortunately, he didn't put any nuclear sauce on it. But it was a cordial relationship. They did what they needed to do, and, but we were only with them for maybe 5 days.
Right. Tell me what kind of equipment your platoon was equipped with when you arrived and what you guys worked with while you were there.
When I first got there, and interestingly enough, I don't know if it's still true today, but an armored cavalry platoon in Vietnam was the most heavily armed ground force in the world. It was amazing what we carried with us. When I first got there, I had nine ACAPs in my platoon, which were basically armored personnel carriers that had been fitted with where the 50 caliber machine gun is in the cupola. We'd fitted a gun shield on it. And then we had an M60 machine gun on either side of the big hatch on the back, and each of those had a gun shield. We carried about a basic load of around 15,000 rounds of machine gun ammunition, along with a lot of other miscellaneous stuff, maybe a law or two, and just all kinds of stuff that we had on the tracks. So we were incredibly well armed.
What did you carry personally?
I carried a 45.
Okay.
I had an M16 or had access to one, but I really just carried a 45.
Okay. Was that your weapon of choice?
Yeah, because really my concept was, and I guess I got a lot of this from Dad and probably from my training too, that the platoon leader that was there to lead, not to be the main bulk of the firepower. I did have one, I go on with my equipment thing and then I get to this story.
Okay.
After I'd been there a couple of months, we turned in three of our ACABs and got Sheridans and trained on those for about a week or so. And then went back out in the field. The Sheridan drivers had grease guns.
Really?
And I thought that was cool, the grease gun. So I decided I would take a grease gun on a dismounted ambush patrol one night. Of course, they fire 40 caliber ammunition. And I remember stuffing my jungle fatigue pockets with big clips of this grease gun ammunition, and that stuff weighed so much. We got out there, and I vowed never to touch a grease gun again in my life. But
how did your equipment function overall? Did you ever have any major problems?
The only real problem we had, we rarely used our M16s. We took them on dismounts and used them there, but they stayed pretty clean because they were on our tracks all the time. The machine guns were great. The major problems we had were with the Sheridans. They were so electrical. I remember the first big firefight we got into after we got our Sheridans. My platoon leader's turret power got stuck on, and he couldn't make the turret stop from going around. And the thought flashed through my mind: you know, if he'd just hold down the trigger on that 50 caliber machine gun, this thing would be all over.
Right.
We also had a little problem with we carried caseless ammunition. For the main gun on the Sheridan, which meant that it was a powder bag rather than a shell casing. And they would sometimes get damp in the wetness and give you a little bit of trouble. But the bigger problem was if you got hit by an RPG in a turret and got into that caseless ammunition, it was just a powder keg. And the Sheridan guys kind of feared that a bit.
Did that ever happen when you were there?
Never did with us. Not my troop.
Was there any weapon that you wish you had but did not have in the field?
No. Well, I think we really had everything that we wanted.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. How about other supplies? Were you always well supplied?
We really were. Of course, we could carry, just a lot of stuff. I rarely got any of it out. I had a duffel bag full of stuff that stayed closed all the time. In fact, I remember we all had a gas mask which remained at the bottom of our duffel bag. I remember we just dropped off the convoy, and we were coming back down some highway up in the Central Highlands for our next rendezvous with wherever we were going, and I got a call from a scout helicopter that told me there was an ambush up ahead of us a few kilometers, and the MDA had gas. And, man, I remember guys pulling stuff out of their duffel bags looking for those gas masks. As it turned out, we never ran into the ambush, so
really? It was
kind of a non-event.
Okay.
But we could carry tape recorders with us if we wanted to tape record messages home.
Did you?
Occasionally, not very often. Because we would operate typically up till about 8 or 9 or 10 at night and then do ambush patrols after that, so we didn't have much time to do that. cameras. I carried a camera with me.
Did you? Did you take a lot of photos?
I took quite a few. Yeah, it was a little bitty. It was a 16-millimeter Minolta, like those little spy camera deals that I keep in my pocket. So I took quite a few photos.
Okay. Could you describe what the typical day was like for you out in the field?
Yeah. Typically, we would be coming in off of an ambush or pulling security for an NDP about 6 o'clock, sometime around first light. We'd pull in the security devices, claymores, flares, or whatever else we had out. Have chow, which was usually sea rations, though about once a month we would get some hot breakfast. From there, we'd go out on some variety of operations, whether that was road security or running with a convoy or what we call busting jungle, looking for the enemy, things like that. We would typically operate until late afternoon, early evening. Again, have sea rations or, again, sometimes a hot meal, but not very often.
When you said you would just basically search for the enemy or run out there in the field, what would you do? You simply just drive down roads, paths?
Yeah, it was typically in the jungle. We called it busting jungle. In fact, that's what they were doing when I first got to the troop, and I thought, what are these guys doing? But basically, they'd have an objective somewhere out in the distance where there might be a suspected base camp or something like that. We just put our tracks in line, put the heaviest one in front, and run over everything that was in front of us, trees, anthills, you name it. And, of course, we never sneaked up on anybody.
That wasn't very quiet, was it?
Although, surprisingly, once or twice, we would get very close and find, hot fires, food still cooking, kind of stuff. Or they would be waiting for you, because they always did it on their terms, the enemy would, and so they'd ambush us on the way in. But busting jungle was kind of interesting.
Was that a mistake to have, looking back at it now, or I guess, did you ever think this when you were there, was it a mistake to be so loud? Was it the tactics, were they sound, or did you say, well, we need to be doing something different here? Or do
I think in our case it was probably good, because we had infantry out operating a different way, more quietly. Actually, George Patton, Jr. was the regimental commander just before I got there, and he had painted in yellow on all of our hatch covers, find the bastards, then pile on. And so he had invented the pile-on technique. The deal was that he would send out a platoon or a small unit to find the enemy. Once we found them, it was our job to hang on to them like a little bulldog until we could get reinforcements in to wipe them out if we hadn't already done so. And it occasionally worked. But like I say, we didn't sneak up on very many people.
Right. Tell me about the relationship you had with the men in the field as that developed over time.
I think it was good. I think they certainly indicated that they respected me. They, for the most part, did what I asked them to do. And it was kind of a two-way deal. I looked out for them, they looked out for me. I had some discipline problems that we dealt with.
How did you deal with them, and what kind of problems were they?
Mostly minor. I would have an occasional... someone who didn't want to go out on an ambush patrol or something, we'd work through that, get it done. The only real mutiny I had one day, I'd been in country for maybe a month, and because we lived on our tracks, you lived with three or four other guys all the time in about a 15-square-foot area, and sometimes tensions would get a little tight, so I decided in all of my first lieutenant wisdom that I would assign guys to different tracks, give them a new home. And I assigned my platoon medic to my track. And when he found out about it, he marched up to me and said, "Sir, I ain't riding on your track." I said, "Really? Why not?" He said, "Two antennas." Well, what I came to find out was that's what the enemy looked for when engaged in combat, two antennas to take out the leader. But he and I worked that out as well. The only other big problem I had, in fact, I guess it was the most scared that I ever was in Vietnam. I was providing security for a convoy, and I had another ACAB right in front of mine. And one of the big deals was staying in uniform, at least in the sense of having your flak jacket, steel helmet, and that protective gear on. And there was one guy on the track in front of me who kept taking off his flak jacket. I would radio up to the track commander and tell him to get his guy back in uniform, and he would. This guy had gotten into some beer because we could carry a lot of beer with us. And he was kind of drunk.
And I did. He was kind of drunk?
Yeah.
Okay.
I did this about three times. And finally, after the third time, the guy took his flak jacket off again, and I radioed the track commander, and I told him I was going to court-martial the guy.
Mm-hmm.
Who was that? The guy turned his M60 machine gun on, scared me to death.
Really?
Yeah, so I stopped the convoy, got the guy off his track, put him on my track where I could keep better watch over him.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing that happened was that not a couple of days later, we got in a huge firefight. And it was in a regimental, NVA regimental base camp. Mm-hmm. Had a lot of bunkers and stuff. This guy was down on the ground checking bunkers. I mean, he was working out like a champ. So after that, I called him aside and I said, look, let's forget everything that happened on the convoy. You did a great job. Just keep your nose clean.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that he did keep his nose clean until after I was wounded. Then he pulled a similar stunt on the next platoon leader. And I heard that the new platoon sergeant took him out behind the bar and did whatever platoon sergeants do to you back there, which mm-hmm. is probably better than a court-martial.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, great relationship
okay.
with the guys.
Now, you said this guy was drunk. He was out on patrol?
Well, we were actually on a convoy, so he was riding on track.
Okay.
One of the fun, we got our Sheridans. They came with a searchlight.
Uh-huh.
The thing we liked the most about the Sheridans was that the searchlight came packed in a styrofoam box, which became a cooler.
And
one of the things that we did get a lot of, we got a lot of ice, a lot of soft drinks, and occasionally we got beer. This guy had gotten into beer, and he was just kind of drunk.
Uh-huh. Was alcohol a problem?
Wasn't really a problem, no. And drugs were not at all a problem.
Okay. Never saw it in your platoon.
I understand from talking to some of my guys that it was done occasionally, but we were out of, away from anywhere where you could get it so much that they didn't have access to it.
Okay. What about any discussion or, you know, as an officer, I'm guessing that maybe this crossed your mind at some point. Maybe it did not, but discussions or any incidents of fragging?
Never occurred to my knowledge in our unit.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I heard about it in other places. Where you would typically hear about it was in a base camp where somebody rolled a grenade into a tent or whatever. And you'd occasionally hear about it in a firefight because it'd be pretty hard to prove who shot you in a firefight.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was probably done. But I don't think we ever really had that problem.
Was it on your mind at all?
No, really wasn't.
Okay. How about any tension between draftees and enlisted men?
None beyond the typical authority that my NCOs had and that their need to be somewhat regimented. But beyond that, really not a lot of conflict.
Okay. How about tension between personnel in the field like yourself and your men and those in the rear?
I would say maybe unfounded animosity.
Okay.
With all those are the rear echelon guys that didn't do anything for a living. As I look back on it now, I understand that's not true. But, we felt like we were carrying the brunt.
Okay. Tell me what your impression was of Vietnam itself, the country.
I might do that on a two-piece thing. I say two parts. My wife and I went back in 1995.
Oh, okay.
It is an incredibly beautiful country.
Uh-huh.
And we found not only before, but when we went back in 95, that the Vietnamese are maybe the friendliest people of any country that I've ever been in.
Mm-hmm.
Extraordinarily welcoming.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was true in 69.
Mm-hmm.
What few of those we ran into, you know, we would do med camps in a village or something, and they were always very cordial to us. Seemed like a nice place, awfully hot and rainy, though.
Mm-hmm. So the civilians treated you well in 95, and you talked about the compassion you had or the emotions you had dealing with the civilians and witnessing what they were going through.
Yeah.
Can you expand on that? And how much contact did you have with them?
We didn't really have a lot. I think we did have a distrust because we heard about, shortly before I got there, a CAV platoon was going down the road and went by a bunch of kids, and they all waved, and then one kid threw a grenade into one of the tracks. So we had that fear because we never knew who the enemy was.
Mm-hmm. You know,
the guy that worked at the barbershop on the base camp was the VC leader.
Mm-hmm.
All he was doing was making a map of your installation.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a distrust in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But to see what those people went through, particularly because we were in the field and we saw mostly villages and the agrarian kind of people, to see their rice paddies getting torn up, their villages getting torn up, just the difficulty they went through night after night, day after day.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of broke my heart.
Mm-hmm. And you felt that way then?
Yeah.
Okay. How about the other men in your platoon?
Kind of mixed. You know, some of them, I hate to use the term, but, you know, they were gooks.
Mm-hmm.
They were with me. They were just a gook all the way.
Mm-hmm.
Others had some compassion.
Okay. How about any kind of race issues in your platoon?
I really didn't have any. I had several blacks. I don't think I had any Hispanics,
mm-hmm.
but I had several blacks in my platoon, and they fit right in. Just one of the guys.
So no problems at all?
No.
Okay. You talked about some civic action that you performed in the villages. What kind of things did you do?
The main thing we would do would be the med cap before we go in with our medics.
Mm-hmm.
Provide some medical support to the villagers.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, that was pretty much all that our platoon did.
Was that voluntary, or were you told to go into certain villages and just see if anybody needed medical attention?
We were told to.
Okay.
It was part of the Win Hearts and Minds.
Right. Did you feel like that was happening? Were hearts and minds being won?
You know, I don't know. They seemed to be very appreciative when we were there.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, we could really see that they were caught in the middle and had to. They sympathized with the enemy at night and thus in the daytime. Whoever's turf they were operating on, they were kind of their friends.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they were appreciative of what we did when we could do those things.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Were you able to take any R&Rs? Were you in country long enough?
No, I was planning on an R&R to Hawaii to meet my wife, but I never made it that long.
Okay. What would you all do for entertainment?
I didn't have time for it.
I was going to... What did you do? I don't know what you would do in the field for entertainment.
Yeah. We really didn't, because after chow at night, we would go out on either a dismounted or mounted ambush patrol,
mm-hmm.
or set up security at a fire support base for the artillery,
mm-hmm.
and then pull a watch a couple times a night.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of the big problems that I had, this was maybe my major problem, was that we stayed going 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
My guys were so tired that
mm-hmm.
when they were pulling watch at night, they would frequently fall asleep.
Really?
Yeah, my platoon sergeant and I would have to get up two or three times a night, go around and check the watch, make sure
mm-hmm.
they were awake.
And would you find them asleep sometimes?
Yeah.
What would you do?
A variety of things. I never court-martialed anybody because I suffered through the same thing they did,
mm-hmm.
Reprimand them. But, you know, that was one of those areas where, maybe stupidly, I felt enough compassion for what they were going through that I knew they knew the danger,
mm-hmm.
and they were just at a point of exhaustion.
Mm-hmm.
I probably actually should have taken more severe action in some cases, but didn't do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you ever use canine units?
Never did.
Okay. Yep. How about, did you have any snipers with you?
Never had a sniper with me. Had a lot of snipers shoot at us.
Mm-hmm.
None with me.
Right. Did you ever work with troops from other countries, Australia, New Zealand, the Koreans?
Actually, when I first got to the troop, we had some CIDG, the Civilian Irregular Defense Group forces that were from Cambodia working with us.
Mm-hmm.
They stayed with us for a week or two. We were operating in the same area as some of the Republic of Korea
mm-hmm.
forces, but never got in contact with them.
Okay.
Heard a lot about the Australians, but never really saw them.
What'd you hear about the Australians?
Good guys, good fighters. I'd like to have a good time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What were your experiences with the dust-off, with the medevac units?
Incredible guys. They were among the heroes of Vietnam. We had a couple of instances that come to mind in a big firefight we were in September,
mm-hmm.
where we'd gotten into this regimental base camp, which was in a rubber plantation, oddly enough, because the rubber plantation, kind of hard to hide a rubber plantation.
Mm-hmm.
They were in there, a whole regimental base camp.
Hmm.
We got into that. We knew that actually one of our sister troops had been ambushed in that area and
mm-hmm.
literally wiped out about a week earlier,
mm-hmm.
so we knew that they were operating in that area. And we went into it with two CAV platoons from my troop coming in one way
mm-hmm.
and M Company, which was our tank company, coming in the other way. So it wasn't a large force, maybe 60, 70 people
mm-hmm.
all told, not having any idea that this was a regimental base camp. But as we got into it, we began got into a really big firefight. And
mm-hmm.
I can recall that we broke into sort of a clearing in this rubber plantation. and we'd taken quite a number of wounded. And I looked across the clearing, and there was a medevac ship coming down. It had a Red Cross painted on the front of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see the pilot, co-pilot's faces, and to my left, an NVA soldier fired an RPG that hit the medevac ship, took it down, killed everybody on board.
Mm.
But, you know, that was a guy that knew what he was coming into, that knew it was a hot LZ,
mm-hmm.
And did it anyway. Another interesting in a different way experience about two nights later, we were still taking some casualties, and we were in the middle of this rubber. And about 10 o'clock, it was a pretty hard rain, and I had to get these guys out.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no clearing around, so I instructed some of my guys to get their tracks, basically break down a landing zone for a dust-off. And so they broke down a bunch of rubber trees. We thought we had a big enough hole for this guy. We called him in, and I can recall standing at the bottom of this rubber tree chimney with a strobe light in my hand, directing the medevac ship down into it. And it turned out we hadn't made the hole quite big enough.
Mm-hmm.
And his rotor tips were literally whacking leaves off the trees as he came down. And I thought, there's no way he's going to make it. Yet he came down, got the guys out. They were
wow.
Amazing. They would do absolutely anything.
Wow. I guess that instilled a lot of confidence in you guys when you were in a firefight. You knew that
really
these...
Good. We knew we were going to get out.
Yeah, they would come after you.
And, you know, the American fighting man basically says, we're not going to leave you behind,
mm-hmm.
no matter what it takes.
Mm-hmm.
So, felt pretty comfortable.
And all your men knew that?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Mr. Dodge, why don't we take a break just for a moment?
Okay.
Okay, Mr. Dodge, let's talk a little bit about your impressions of the enemy. What can you tell me about general impressions of the NVA and the VC?
The first thing I would say is that they were much more resilient and better fighters than I thought they would be
mm-hmm.
when I went over.
Both the VC and the NVA? Or?
Yeah, we didn't really encounter the VC very much.
Mm-hmm.
We really did more with the NVA.
Mm-hmm.
But they were very good at preparing the battlefield before a fight, you know, having their stuff there and being ready.
Mm-hmm.
They seemed to have good intelligence in that, certainly in terms of our base camps, because they would have their people working there and mapping them out one
mm-hmm.
thing and another.
Mm-hmm.
Masters of ambush and concealment.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, being a cav platoon, they could move much more easily in the terrain than we could.
Mm-hmm.
So it could be a hit and run if that's what they wanted it to be.
Mm-hmm. What would you say their weaknesses were?
I think one of their main weaknesses was that they became maybe a bit rudderless when they lost their leaders.
Mm-hmm.
They tended to operate in cells, and they kind of did what the head guy said. When the head guy wasn't there anymore, they were without instruction. So that was a problem for them.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, they were not equipped, you know, even in any way near what we were.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So that was a big a problem for them in a sense, and yet not a problem in that they were a lot more mobile because of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And medical resources, I think, were a huge problem for them.
Okay. What? How could you describe their tactics? What do they usually use, the NVA?
I guess the two areas where we typically encountered them, one would have been on a convoy
mm-hmm.
where they were in ambush along the road, and they would normally initiate the ambush with a command detonated mine
mm-hmm.
that would take out a lead vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Or RPGs. RPGs and mines were really our two biggest problems.
Sounds like they still are in Iraq right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, that's right. And it's funny how that same old RPG is just cranking along.
Yes.
It hasn't changed it any.
Absolutely.
Great weapon.
Mm-hmm.
So those were our two big problems.
Mm-hmm.
How
did you deal with that? Did you draw straws, see who would be in the lead vehicle?
Yeah, I was the guy who drew the straw, and somebody else was the lead vehicle. the issue of mines, wherever we went, that was always a problem. We always did what we call tracking, where the first guy would take the risk and everybody else would stay in his tracks
mm-hmm.
with the theory that if he didn't hit one, you didn't hit one either,
mm-hmm.
which worked most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
We never got mine plate for any of the vehicles in my platoon. It was a large steel plate that bolted on the bottom
mm-hmm.
of the vehicle.
Did you request them?
We did. It was just starting to come into the 11th Cav while
mm-hmm.
I was there, and other units got it. We never did get it.
Mm-hmm.
But we would try to protect the driver, for example, with sandbags underneath them.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the crew rode on top of the vehicle rather than in the vehicle.
Okay.
You got blown off, but you didn't get blown up.
Right.
Hopefully.
Right.
convoys was one. The other place we typically engaged the enemy was on ambush patrols at night out in the jungle.
Can you tell me what they were like?
Yeah, we would do them two ways. Sometimes they were mounted. We'd actually take either the platoon or part of the platoon to a trail or a trail junction and set up there. The other way would be a dismounted patrol where we left the platoon and went on foot, taking whatever you needed.
Which were more effective?
Dismounted.
Okay.
They could typically sense when you were there, were with the platoon or with your vehicles. And in those cases, they generally attacked you rather than falling into your ambush.
Okay. So how? Go ahead.
The real workable ambushes were the dismounted ones.
How often would you set the ambushes? Was this nightly?
Yeah, pretty much every night, unless we were in a fire support base doing security for the artillery.
Okay. How often were you doing that?
We maybe did that a night a week.
Okay.
So most of the time we were out on ambush patrols.
Okay. Can you describe how you would set up an ambush, how you would direct your men to do that?
Yeah, it kind of depended on the lay of the land, but we would typically maybe do an L-shaped ambush where part of us would be down a side of the trail and then the foot of the L would go across the trail. Normally we were in fairly wooded terrain on those, though sometimes we were just out in open area, tall grass, but nothing else. The mounted ambush patrols were almost always in a wooded area, just never out in the open.
You mean just straight in the jungle, in the wooded area?
Yeah, in the jungle or in a rubber plantation.
Okay.
Being in the open, and we were too visible even at night with tracks, you could tell we were there.
Right. Okay. Let's talk about your combat experiences. What was your first experience with combat?
The first one was, I guess, in June, not too long after I'd gotten there. We were ambushed on Highway 13, which we call Thunder Road, by an NVA force. And I remember that was the first time I'd ever seen a dead enemy soldier, just laying there on the ground. Kind of a weird feeling.
Really? What was that like?
Strange. I almost can't even describe it. It wasn't... I'm not sure how I could describe it. It was just strange to see a guy there totally lifeless. You know, I'd never seen anybody totally... Well, I'd seen some people lifeless, but not very many. And certainly not under those circumstances.
What happened in that ambush?
We were going south on Highway 13, and they had set up a an ambush just off the side of the road. We had... Highway 13 had a lot of vegetation that grew in close to the road, and over a period of time, we got our engineers with their roam plows to come in and widen the buffer on either side of the road, but at that time it was not widened. And they had set an ambush with several mines just off the side of the road and then enemy beyond the mines with the hope that, first of all, we would turn into them and hit the mines. Fortunately, I was new enough, so I wasn't really directing operations. My guys knew what to do anyway, and they immediately went into a herringbone formation where one track turned right and the next one turned left, and then we opened up, and if you can imagine, we had, at that time, 18 M60 machine guns and 9 50 caliber machine guns all going at the same time. It's pretty devastating. The enemy didn't often attack an armored cavalry platoon unless they were really ready for you because of the firepower. And the fight didn't last long. We had no injured at all.
How long did it last, would you guess?
7 or 8 minutes, maybe.
Okay.
Real short.
And that was your first taste of combat in Vietnam.
Yeah, and the feeling that I had, the real memory that fits with me, at the time I had, let's see, I was the fifth guy on my track. So I had a driver, I had a track commander in the cupola, and then I had a man on each M60 machine gun on either side of the hatch on the top of the vehicle, and I was standing in the middle, and basically my job was to direct the platoon, and I had my CVC helmet on that had radio earphones in it, and three machine guns around me, and when everything opened up, it was the most noise I think I've ever heard in my life, even with that CVC helmet.
Right.
Rather exhilarating.
Was it what you had expected, or was it completely different, or what?
It was a lot faster than I expected. You know, I thought when you got in the fight, man, you were just, you fought for a long time. It was over so fast.
Was that typical?
Yeah, most of the time it was. You know, they might last 30 minutes, but 30 minutes was long. Most of them were short, 5 or 10 minutes.
Okay.
And it was over. Because what they would normally do is they'd hit you, and when they knew that their advantage was gone. They were out of there, heading back to Cambodia. And that was a frustration for us. We operated most of the time near Cambodia. And, of course, that was sanctuary to them. We couldn't go in there.
Right.
And very frustrating.
Tell me about that. Did you discuss this with your men?
Yeah. It was a common topic of the conversation.
Did you ever make any requests to cross the border and go in after them?
We did. That and to fire artillery in across the line, and we never was granted.
Did you know exactly where that line was?
Pretty close. Kind of hard to tell sometimes when you're in the jungle and you're looking at that map, and I think we probably crossed it a few times, but for the most part we stayed on our side. There was actually, they may have called it a demilitarized zone, but if you looked at the map, there was the borderline between the countries, and then there literally was a buffer zone that we weren't supposed to go into that was several hundred meters, I guess, on either side of the boundary line of the countries.
Okay. Tell me about your other combat experiences in the I guess you were there for 5 months before you were wounded and evacuated. Tell me what else. You mentioned one at a rubber plantation.
Yeah, there. One of the big ones that I was in was on September 7th is when it started in the rubber plantation. We had had our E troop, which was with another squadron, had been literally annihilated in that area. We didn't know what was there. We just thought it was a huge ambush. And so we went in with our two platoons from my troop and then the platoon from M Company. And we started out, it was kind of interesting. Captain Tutt was my troop commander. We had my platoon on the left and a fellow named Jack Andrews on the right. Or was it Jack or Randy? I think maybe it was Randy Crane on the right. And Captain Tutt's vehicle was in the middle. So we were stretched out on a line moving up in across the field into this rubber plantation. And Tutt was a great guy, but he was a fiery guy. And when he wanted to be done, he wanted to be done right now kind of guy. And as we moved just into the edge of the rubber, we began taking RPGs, small arms, even some 51 caliber anti-aircraft machine gun fire. So we knew there was something big in there. And rubber plantations were kind of odd in that communication was always difficult in Vietnam, but in a rubber plantation, for some reason, you could see the guy 50 yards away you were trying to talk to on the radio, and they wouldn't communicate.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know what it was. But as we moved into this rubber plantation, communication between the other platoon leader and Captain Tutt went out, and it was driving Tutt nuts because he couldn't talk to this guy. But he could still talk to me, so he was relaying all the commands and what have you for the other platoon leader through me, and that was fine as long as he could talk to somebody. And we continued to move into this rubber plantation, and the fire built. It got hotter and hotter, and then all of a sudden my communications went out, and I could see Captain Tutt probably 50 yards away from me. Couldn't talk to anybody. He was going absolutely berserk, and I became more afraid of what he was going to do to me than what the NVA was going to do to me if I didn't get my radios working. So I get down the track, and I'm turning dials and, you know, trying to get the thing up, and nothing works. So I stood back up, and I looked down, and we had a what we called a spaghetti cord. It was a stretchy, like a telephone cord that went from the headset down to the radio. And I looked down, and right in the middle of my chest, actually through the spaghetti cord, there was a flechette from a main gun round from either one of my Sheridans or from the tank coming in the other way. And it had knocked the communications out. So I replaced the spaghetti cord, and we were back in business, and Tutt settled down again. That was going to be my one big war trophy when I came home, and when I got medevac, they threw it away. But we got into that regimental base camp and found a lot of very heavily defended bunkers and tunnels. That was the area where the guy that had almost blown me away on the convoy really worked out like a champ, checking bunkers and doing stuff on the ground. And my dad had always taught me in preparation, I guess, he said, never expect your men to do something you haven't already done or wouldn't do yourself. So I took the first turn going into a tunnel, and I remember I had my .45 and a flashlight, started crawling into this tunnel. I was scared to death. I'd never been in a tunnel before in my life. And as I was going in, I met an NVA soldier coming out who had a grenade in his hand.
And
we were maybe 4 feet away from each other, three feet or something, really close. And I can remember, you know, how it's amazing how much stuff you can think about in an instant of time. And I thought, this guy's probably got a family at home with kids, and he's doing his job just like I'm doing my job, and now it became a matter, really, of who could pull the trigger first, and
right.
I did. The 45 blew him back into the tunnel, and I never saw him again. It really shook me up.
Right. Was that the first time you had to do something like that?
That was the only close time, yeah, because, you know, so many times when you're in combat, certainly in Vietnam, you didn't see the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
It was just all in jungle, and you never saw anybody.
Mm-hmm.
So to have a face-to-face confrontation like that was made it very personal,
mm-hmm.
Brought a whole different kind of look to the war to me.
Did anybody see this happen?
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, I got a Bronze Star for it.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Funny about the reports they write up for Valor, the original report I was able to read several years after I left Vietnam, and mm-hmm. it didn't sound anything like the one that actually went on the medal.
Mm-hmm.
But that firefight lasted 2-3 days running, and interestingly enough, the first day we were checking bunkers, and we began finding enemy soldiers that looked a little unusual. They were bigger than we expected,
mm-hmm.
and they turned out to be Chinese advisors. In fact,
really?
On the stuff that I sent you, I know there was a question about did you ever
mm-hmm.
beat any foreign enemy troops, and
yes.
I said no, but I'd forgotten about that.
Mm-hmm.
There were about six of them that had been killed.
Mm-hmm.
And they were larger, looked a little different.
Did this surprise you?
Yeah, really did. Really did.
This let me go back quickly. You said that your men really wanted to see how you would react in the first firefight, in the first one that you described. Afterward, did you sense a change in attitude toward you? Were you kind of proven to them at that point?
You know, I think that they were so respectful anyway, just
mm-hmm.
in the way they acted, that I didn't really notice a change that I recall.
Okay.
Although in talking to them, they say they noticed a change.
In you?
Well, in the way they, in their perception of me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, besides the firefight you just described at the rubber plantation, what other incidents come to mind when you think about those 5 months in country?
The last one when I was medevaced.
Okay. Why don't you tell me about
another,
that?
Another one, August, I had gone into Saigon for a friend of mine was commanding a friend of my dad's was commanding, and he was having a change of command ceremony, so I flew in to...
I'm sorry, Mr. Dodge, you just cut out just for a second.
A friend of my dad's was the commander of the Big Red One,
okay.
and there was a change of command ceremony,
mm-hmm.
so I flew in for the ceremony.
Okay.
And on the way back out, I helicoptered into Quan Loi, which was then the Black Horse Base Camp
mm-hmm.
out in the area where we operated.
Mm-hmm.
Spent one night there, and was basically on my own because I wasn't, you know, my unit was out in the field. I
mm-hmm.
was just hanging out there. And we got a pretty big attack that night.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just sort of a loose cannon with a 45 trying to figure out what I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
They hit us pretty hard. In fact, the interesting thing happened. They actually captured or had a Chu Hoi, one of the sappers that came into through the wire.
Mm-hmm.
Chu Hoi'd, and the next day, he put on a demonstration of how they got through the wire, and it was
really?
Just amazing.
What did they do?
He stripped down to just sort of black shorts,
mm-hmm.
so no clothing on at all, and he got on the outside of the wire and basically slipped through it without cutting anything, got all the way through it without setting off a flare or anything. It was amazing that they could do that. I think a lot of times they actually cut the wire when they could.
Mm-hmm.
And they would scope you out. They'd know where a lot of your flares and claymores and things were
mm-hmm.
in advance.
Did you feel like that the Americans were winning the war when you were there? Did you have that sense?
I did, yeah.
Okay.
I did, although I felt the frustration of the home front turning away from the war.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt like as far as we were concerned there, we were winning the war, except that you fought for the same ground over and over again. You know,
mm-hmm.
we kept asking ourselves, what are we doing here? What are we trying to accomplish?
Mm-hmm.
It was pure body camp. You know, that's all we were doing was trying to get a body camp.
Tell me about that policy. What did you think of that?
You know, I guess if you're trying to fight a war of attrition,
mm-hmm.
if both sides have the same mindset, it might work.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't have the same mindset they did. They were going to throw as many people at us as it took for
mm-hmm.
as long as it took.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we'd kill 90 of theirs, we'd lose one. We'd think we were winning, but we really weren't.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't understand that.
Mm-hmm.
We really thought, man, if we killed 90 guys to one of ours, we're winning the war.
Right. Right. What about the one-year rotation? Did you think that was a good idea, or should men have been left to fight the war to its finish, say, like World War II?
I think it was actually worse for officers, because mm-hmm. typically we only spent 6 months in the field.
That's right.
Before we rotated to XO or something else.
Mm-hmm.
The theory being get your ticket punched and get as many officers with experience as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was very workable. You tended to lack cohesion in that there were always new guys coming in,
mm-hmm.
Other than the boat people who went over originally. Nobody went over as a unit.
Mm-hmm.
You were just sort of a conglomeration of people. And I think that the NCO Corps and the enlisted guys really took a dim view of the fact that officers spent 6 months in the field and then they were gone.
Right.
That was kind of a problem.
Mm-hmm. I guess you didn't have that problem, did you?
No.
Do you want to tell me about that incident when you were medevac?
Yeah. Somme Bay, actually Fire Support Base Buttons, was right near by the provincial capital of Somme Bay Province,
mm-hmm.
which is up by the Cambodian border.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a 1st Cavalry Division Fire Support Base. Colonel Shai Meyer, who eventually became Chief of Staff of the Army, was the battalion commander there.
Mm-hmm.
And Nixon was about to make a speech, and this was in early November.
Mm-hmm.
The NVA knew that he was going to, and they wanted to do all that they could to draw attention away from him.
Mm-hmm.
And so they contemplated a series of attacks on a fairly wide area,
mm-hmm.
but mainly up in that area where we were. So the 1st Cav had gotten intelligence that Fire Support Base Buttons was going to be hit by a large enemy force.
Mm-hmm.
So they brought in I-Troop from the 11th Cav, which was my troop,
mm-hmm.
to provide a little additional security. And we were there for maybe 3 days,
mm-hmm.
each night thinking that would be the night of the attack. And oddly enough, my platoon, this is really weird, and my guys struggle about this to this day, but Fire Support Base Buttons had the typical 6-foot-high earthen berm all the way around it with
mm-hmm.
bunkers dotted all along, and 3 rows of concertina wire outside the berm. Shai Meyer commanded my platoon to go out and set up outside the berm in between 2 rows of concertina wire.
Okay.
Which meant that, A, we didn't have the protection of the berm, and, B, we were stuck in between the wire.
Right.
The cav platoons like to be mobile.
Mm-hmm.
But my troop commander objected. We all objected. But, anyway, that was the deal. So we went out and set up. And at the time, I only had six vehicles operating,
mm-hmm.
about 23 guys. And we set up outside the berm. What I have learned later, in fact, I talked to General Meyer a few years ago, and he said that we were hit by an enemy force of about 3,000 or 4,000. It was a huge enemy force.
Mm.
And when they came in, as it turned out, just by our luck, my platoon was on one side of the berm, and we came up to one corner, and there was a tower on that corner.
Mm-hmm.
And the main thrust of the NVA attack came up a draw to that tower because they
mm-hmm.
could see the tower, and that was something for them to guide on. So
mm-hmm.
basically they were coming right into my platoon.
Mm-hmm.
As it turned out, it's kind of funny. I was sitting on a lawn chair on top of the track pulling guard about 1 o'clock at night. I don't know where I got the lawn chair. But the first rockets and mortars and all that started coming in. We knew that it was about to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I threw that lawn chair. I don't know where it went. But as soon as the barrage was over, the ground attack started. And, of course, they were hitting buttons from all sides.
Mm-hmm.
We had a huge volume of fire coming from our front, which was kind of coming across an open field with a lot of high grass in it. And at some point, maybe, I don't know, 20 minutes into the battle, the NVA actually broke through the perimeter on the other side of the fire support base,
mm-hmm.
got inside, fought their way across the fire support base, and they got in the bunkers behind my platoon because there was no infantry behind us
mm-hmm.
since we were out there. But we didn't know that they were out there. As it turned out, I had one track on the right, which was down by the tower. Mine was next, and then the others went off to my left.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, that track on the right got hit actually by 4 RPGs. I lost one guy, and all the rest were wounded,
mm-hmm.
and the track caught on fire. And the guys on that track came up toward my track and went on by me. at that point, we still didn't know the enemy was behind us.
Mm-hmm.
So I had three guys on my track that night, and Mike Chakowski was on the 50 caliber in the cupola, and I was manning one of the M60 machine guns and the radios, and a guy named Bob Harvey was on the right M60.
Mm-hmm.
And we were basically fighting to our front. And for some reason, we had the back ramp of the ACAB down. I can't remember if we had hydraulic problems or whatever it was. But, Harvey ran out of ammunition, ducked down into the track to get another box of ammo, and the first RPG came into my track from the right rear, and it blew him out the back.
Mm-hmm.
Went through my right leg. I didn't feel any pain, but I knew I'd been hit. And it was, even though we had flares up, it was pretty dark on the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
So I reached down to check out the damage, and I remember my leg feeling like warm jello. And my first thought was, hey, I'm going home. But I had this more immediate problem. So I called my troop commander to tell him that we were being hit pretty hard, not knowing that that RPG had also gone through my radios.
Mm-hmm.
But I continued to fire the machine gun.
Mm-hmm.
And about the time I ran out of machine gun ammunition, another RPG came through the track. And I decided that was an invitation for me to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd forgotten the back ramp was down. So I crawled up out of the hatch, and I got up on top of the ACAB, and they're maybe 6 feet high. And I remember falling off the edge and landing in a big puddle, and I was lying on my back in this puddle, and I reached down to check out my leg, and it was gone. I mean, I thought that guy had blown my leg off.
Really?
Yeah, I found out that I'd really gotten shrapnel from head to toe, and blew away most of my right thigh, about 3 inches of the femur. So without the femur, it was kind of a wet noodle.
Mm-hmm.
It had folded up underneath me. And eventually, I figured out what happened, and I got myself turned over, and I crawled around behind the track thinking there's safety back there, not knowing still that the NVA were in the bunkers behind us.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how long I was there before some guys from another track came, and the vivid memory I have right then, if you recall in comic books when somebody gets punched out and they see stars,
mm-hmm.
when they lifted me up, I'd lost a lot of blood by then. And
right.
The remaining blood just rushed out of my head. It looked like the 4th of July. I mean, it was the most amazing thing I've ever seen.
Really? You remember that to this day?
Yeah, it's just incredible.
Now, you said you were experiencing very little pain?
Yeah, not much that I remember. I think the shock just, at that point, blocked it out. They got me back to a more secure area and shot me up with some morphine. And then my next kind of big memory was they took me into a little aid station. And there was an operating room down there or some kind of thing. They had some metal tables. And they tore my jungle fatigues off and put me on this metal table. And the memory I have there was that it was so cold that my chest muscles contracted. And I felt like I couldn't breathe. I was afraid I was going to smother. So they got me in some sort of a splint. This was maybe 1:30 in the morning. And finally, by about, I guess, around 5, the battle had died down enough to get some medevac choppers in, and I was airlifted out.
You must have lost a lot of blood.
Yeah, I think by the time they got me to the aid station, I'd probably lost an awful lot of blood, because literally the whole right side of my thigh was gone.
How close to death do you think you were?
In Korea, I guess I'd have been dead.
Right.
You know, any other war.
Mm-hmm.
Might have died, but gosh, our medical support was so good in Vietnam.
Looking back at that, how do you feel about that today? I mean, that's obviously a highly traumatic event and physically affected you, and the war ended for you there, I guess.
One of the most significant experiences of my life,
mm-hmm.
And I guess everybody that goes into combat goes in with the thought, can I cut the mustard? Mm-hmm. What am I going to do if I get shot?
Mm-hmm.
And you never know unless you do. And, you know, I just think back on it as a positive experience.
Do you really?
Yeah.
Did you think that at the time?
I think I did. Yeah.
How is that possible? I'm not doubting you at all, but
yeah.
how can you explain that to people who might be listening to this or reading this interview in the future? How can you see that as a positive thing for you?
I was not a Christian then. I would have a different view of it now, but my mom was very much a fatalist. She said, you know, what's going to happen to you is going to happen to you. You just go make the best of it.
Okay.
And that's the way she observed everything in life. That was just her outlook.
Mm-hmm.
And so I figured if it was my time to get shot, that was just part of the deal. You go make the best of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember an odd thing happened. My last memory of the battlefield was being carried on a stretcher to a chopper, and there were four guys carrying the stretcher, and The only one that I remembered over the years was that one of them was a first cab chaplain. I didn't know who he was, but I knew he was a chaplain. So I got loaded on board, and I was gone. And my wife, I'm not much of a reunion guy, but finally in 91 or early 90s, my wife and I went to a reunion in San Antonio. And we went into this huge room where it was kind of the general meeting room, and everybody brought their memorabilia and scrapbooks and all that. And they had them on tables around the edge of the room. And when I walked in, my wife had gone off to look at some stuff on some tables, and a guy walked up to me and looked at me and said, "Are you Lieutenant Dodge?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I'm Bob Walker, and I was one of the guys that carried your stretcher to the helicopter." I said, "Man, this has made the reunion."
Wow.
Then my wife comes over. She says, "Ty, you got to come see something on this table over here." So I went over. In fact, I've still got the piece of paper. There's a piece of spiral notebook paper ripped out of a notebook. And on it is written, "My name is Chaplain Gene Allen. I helped the 11th Cav when they were attacked outside the Berman Buttons. If you remember me, call." I thought, man, that's got to be the chaplain. So I called, and he was just getting ready to go out of town. And he didn't even know the 11th Cav was in town, except that he was a hospital chaplain, and he had been at a seminar in our hotel and saw our banners. So he rips this note out of his notebook and sticks it on the table in there. So we went out and had a reunion. So now I've met two of my stretcher bearers, which has been pretty cool.
I can imagine. So did your experience in country affect your religious beliefs at all?
I don't think it did at the time. As I look back on it now, it did. I mean, it does now. Having a different view of eternity and how you get there. From my point of view, I can see how foolish it is going into combat without some assurance of an eternity.
Right.
But I really didn't have that perception back then.
Okay.
One interesting thing, though, that did happen. We were out in the absolute middle of nowhere on some road. I didn't know where we were. And I stopped my platoon for a maintenance break on the road. We were all kind of stretched out on this dirt road. And way down at the other end of my platoon, I see a little white car drive up, and it stopped next to the last track. And a guy got out, and he's talking to the guys in the track, and then he moves up to the next track. I wonder, what's this guy doing? Turned out to be a Korean who was selling white leather-covered Bibles. And
really?
Man, they were going like hotcakes.
He was a civilian?
Yeah.
Wow.
He's out there riding around in the war zone.
He's doing some serious work for God out
That's
there.
That's right. Absolutely.
Wow. What's the shape of your leg today, if I might ask?
I run on it, backpack on it.
Oh, wow.
Still, the right side of my thigh is still gone. I just got a thin covering of scar tissue over the bone.
Okay.
But
you're fully mobile?
Yeah.
That's great.
I've actually lost some flexibility in it, but it works pretty well. Thanks goodness to America's military medicine.
Let me ask you a couple other questions about life in the field. Did you ever run into any unusual, or what kind of wild animals did you run into?
Heard a lot of stories about wild animals, but the only things we ran into, I did have one trooper. We were out busting jungle, and a scorpion dropped out of a tree and snagged him, and we had to medevac him. I lost a few to malaria, and I guess the worst ones were, as we were busting jungle, these voracious red ants would build nests in trees, and when you shook their perch, they'd drop down on you, and they ate armored cavalry for lunch. They were awful. And they get down your clothes and all, but other than that, really didn't see much.
Okay.
We did have one sort of a disheartening experience. We broke out into a...
I'm sorry, you cut off again. Broke out into what?
I'm getting a... Let this call beep through.
Okay.
It's over. Yeah, we've broken out into this clip. Still there?
Yes, I am. Okay. Broke out into a clearing.
Yeah, broke out into a clearing, and about, I don't know, 50 yards away, there's a peacock standing over there in full array. And all of a sudden, I guess 9 M60 machine guns opened up on that peacock.
Oh, God.
And that sucker just walked off the battlefield, and I thought, man.
Everyone missed.
Everybody missed.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Did your unit have any pets? I know that might be an odd question for...
We did. No, we did. We had a little dog, kind of a mutt named Tanker.
Oh, yeah?
That rode around, and he had a little buddy that was a real mutt, a totally indescribable mutt, that we called Uncle Ho. You might think that we called him Uncle Ho playing off Ho Chi Minh.
Yes, sir.
But the name Ho was actually a contraction of the initials H-O, which stood for hood ornament, because he liked to ride on the 50, right under the 50 caliber machine gun on one of the tracks.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's funny, when I do a Vietnam testimony to youth groups and stuff like that, I tell them about that, and they all look at me because they've never seen a hood ornament before.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's very true.
Yeah.
So you said you had Tanker and Uncle Ho.
Uncle Ho.
With you. Did they last with you the whole time you were there?
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. Ho used to, in a firefight, he was typically the first one to arrive, being on the front of the track,
mm-hmm.
and he'd stand up underneath that 50 caliber machine gun and just give the enemy fits, you know, bullets snapping around him, and I thought, that old guy's crazy. But I did notice that he and Tanker both lasted longer than all the platoon leaders in our, in our platoon. We had, in a period of about 6 months, well, in our troop, we had three platoons, so each one had a platoon leader.
Mm-hmm.
Just before I got there, the platoon leader of my platoon was killed. On November 4th, two of us were RPG'd and medevaced.
Mm-hmm.
The next month, the other platoon leader was killed, and then shortly after that, another one. So we lost platoon leaders like crazy.
Mm.
But the mascots seemed to do okay. We should have listened to them more.
Tell me what you think was the bravest action you witnessed in Vietnam.
In Vietnam, I would have to say the dust-off guys.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that comes to my mind, I had a great track commander, a guy named Gary Pinion, who was a story all unto himself. And we were in this rubber plantation late one July afternoon, and I'd moved our platoon into a new area.
Mm-hmm.
It had been swept by the engineers for mines, so we didn't expect any mines. But he was down on the ground guiding his track into position. And the track ran over a rather large mine. He was standing about 3 feet from it. I mean, it shredded him. It blew his face off. Just really shredded. And standing in the middle of that minefield, or, you know, sitting in the middle of this minefield, I guess six or seven other guys immediately jumped off their tracks at dead run, picking their way through whatever they didn't know was down there to get to them,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of that look after each other thing, but
mm-hmm.
awful lot of bravery. Saw a lot of bravery after Vietnam in the hospital as well.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Can you describe that?
Yeah, there was a guy, when I was at Camp Zama, the guy next to me, had been shot in the hand, which I think is probably one of the most complicated bone structures in the body.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very infected, and a lot of crushed bone and stuff. And several times a day, they would come inject saline solution into the wound, and
mm-hmm.
then they would have to massage the hand to squeeze the infection out.
Mm.
And, you know, you could just, the color would just drain out of his face.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, he just set an example for us.
Mm-hmm.
That I had another interesting experience when I was in, I guess it was before I actually got out of the country. I was in a body cast. That was my shipping container initially.
Okay.
With a large broken bone. It started just under my armpits and went down both legs.
Mm.
So I was kind of like a stranded turtle, and
mm-hmm.
I'd been there a couple of weeks, and one day my attitude just checked out on me. I became a huge pain in the neck to the hospital staff around me.
What were you doing?
Just complaining, whining, you know, why aren't you paying more attention to me? And I could see other guys who were in a lot worse shape than I was in, but they weren't paying attention to me, and I didn't think that was fair.
Mm-hmm.
And I was laying there in my stranded turtle grand funk one day, and a guy came into our ward. The door was about 20 beds away, and
mm-hmm.
the door opened. This guy walks in, and his head is completely wrapped in bandages, and you couldn't see any part of his head or his face. And
mm-hmm.
he was sort of shuffling along, kind of navigating by braille, and every now and then he'd stop at a bed and he'd lean over, looked like he would say something to the guy in the bed, and then he'd shuffle on to the next one. Frankly, I watched him with self-pity in my heart. You know, at least that guy can get out of bed.
Mm-hmm.
I had what my wife, who was a kindergarten teacher, would call a DRA, a dirty rotten attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually he got to my bed. He actually ran into it, just bumped into it. When
mm-hmm.
he did, he reached out with his hand, and it brushed across my cast, and he thumped on my cast, and he leaned over, and in this kind of a muffly, gruffly voice, he said, "Man, what happened to you? They got you wrapped in concrete. You
mm-hmm.
going to be okay? You going to get to go home anytime soon?"
Mm-hmm.
Just as I was about to answer him, the guy in the bed next to me leaned over. He said, "Don't need to answer him." I said, "Really? Why not?" He said he lost his hearing and most of his face to a mortar round. He can't hear you. And I looked back at the guy, and when I did, he leaned over, and in that kind of a low, gruffly voice, he said, "Hang tough, dude. I'm praying for you."
Mm.
Just shuffled away, and I said, "Man, my tears just—I couldn't see through the tears."
Mm-hmm.
But you know, here's a guy looking out for other people
mm-hmm.
in his own misery.
Wow. What happened? You were in the hospital there for a couple of weeks. Then were you taken out of country?
Yeah, I was in the hospital in Saigon for about 2 weeks while they stabilized me.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting thing that happened there in the body cast. In fact, two things. I was laying there one day, kind of asleep, and you know how you can sometimes tell that there are people around you?
Yes.
You just sense that there are people. I opened my eyes, and there were colonels and captains and majors. And I thought, what's going on? And I, standing at the foot of my bed was George Wallace, and I couldn't remember his name.
Mm-hmm.
I knew he was the governor of Alabama, but I couldn't remember his name. So
really?
That was one experience. Then they shipped me to another hospital near Benoit. They were trying to get my hematocrit count of my blood up, and they'd gotten it fairly stabilized. So the last night before I was supposed to go out, they said, we need to get you up just a little higher. The nurse came by and said, would you like anything to drink? And I'd been on just IV up until then. I said, oh, man, I'd love a Coke. So she brings me this Coke, and simultaneously they start giving me injections of blood. And to do it, they hang a blood bag up, and they put a blood pressure cuff on it and squeeze it tight so it'd pump it in faster. Well, with the carbonation of the Coke and this blood getting pumped into me, I began to swell into this body cast.
Really?
I felt like a tick. Yeah, I thought I was going to bust out of that thing. But anyway, from there they sent me to Camp Zion in Japan, and I stayed there about two months. And then in early January, they shipped me to Maxwell Air Force Base in Montgomery, and I remained there from January through June. And interestingly enough, my daughter was born while I was in the hospital there. She'd been conceived,
really?
Unknowing to us, yeah, just before I went over.
Mm-hmm.
So she was born while I was in the hospital.
Wow. Now, what did your wife hear about your injury? How did she hear this?
She was home. She had an apartment in Tuscaloosa, and her parents lived not too far away. And she kind of knew the military routine, you know, two guys show up at the door sort of thing when your husband's dead. A cab pulled up to the door and came and knocked on it and said he had a telegram for her. She said, I'm not going to read it. I can't read it. So she called her dad. And he came over and read it, and it said, basically described that I'd been wounded and what my condition was and what have you. But the Army was really good about keeping her informed, very good about regular updates and whatever. And some of that may have been the fact that Dad had some influence on that, I guess, though I never knew that.
Right.
But she was very well informed.
Okay. When were you able to see her for the first time?
January, and says wounded for November, and I actually got back in country about the 10th of January.
Okay. How much did you write home? How much contact did you have with home while you were there in Vietnam?
A fair amount. In fact, I've got a number of my, several people saved the letters, so I've still got them. But I would write every few days anyway, and I got a fair amount of mail back.
How important was the mail to you?
Pretty important, yeah. Interesting, because they're now all real muddy. They've got they look like Vietnam.
How would you describe the leadership in Vietnam?
The leadership, you know, I really didn't have much contact with the upper leadership, the guys who were making the strategic decisions. But the leadership from regimental level down, I was pretty close to. And I was very impressed with it. They were, they didn't take risks just for the sake of taking risks, but they were aggressive, tried to get the job done. They listened to you. I was impressed.
Okay. When you arrived back in the States, what kind of reception did you get? What are your memories of that?
You know, it was kind of funny, I guess, because I came back through the medevac system, so everybody I met was sympathetic to me, and I didn't experience any of that, getting spit on at the airport and all that stuff, because I was in the medical system, so it was basically good, very positive.
How long were you in the hospital there at Fort Maxwell?
From January to June.
Okay.
So almost about 5 months, 5.5 months.
Okay, and did you go back to active duty?
Yeah, I went back on convalescent duty for about 6 months there in Tuscaloosa with the National Guard unit as an advisor, and then in the fall, went out to Fort Carson, Colorado, and it was that point kind of my wife and I, both having grown up military families, and having moved as much as we did during the short time we were in, we're really getting tired of being rootless. And so I was going through a process then of deciding whether I really wanted to stay in or not. And really the military was different during Vietnam than the military we had been used to during our growing up years. We just, you know, a huge infusion of people, different atmosphere and everything. And so we decided that after my 3 years, I had a regular Army commission, that after 3 years I would get out. So I finished out my tour at Fort Carson.
How did your father feel about that?
you know, he was a guy that always supported me and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the hardest things that I ever had to tell him, was that I'm getting out of the military, because mm-hmm. I was afraid of what his reaction would be, but it was great.
Hmm.
He said, you know, you got to do what you got to do.
I bet that meant a lot to you.
It really did. Really did.
So how much did you talk about your Vietnam experiences once you were back in the States permanently, I guess, and then after Fort Carson, after 71?
I think my experience may be similar to an awful lot of Vietnam vets.
Mm-hmm.
We came back from an experience that was kind of like going to the Grand Canyon with a $3 throwaway camera, taking a picture and trying to describe to somebody what the Grand Canyon is like. You can't do it.
That's a good analogy.
And while people were cordial and they were polite,
mm-hmm.
they couldn't relate, and they really wanted to talk about other stuff. And so basically I stuffed it.
Hmm.
And
Did you keep it off your job applications?
No. It was on there. I was proud of it, but mm-hmm. I just didn't push it on anybody because I didn't mm-hmm. think they wanted to hear about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when I really started to open up was maybe in the early 90s when I went to that first reunion. I mm-hmm. began just voraciously reading Vietnam books
mm-hmm.
and meeting other veterans and talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Still, I think most people are polite, but they can't really relate to it,
mm-hmm.
which I think is, in fact, I'm kind of a closet writer. After one of my reunions, I wrote for our Thunder Run, our regimental newspaper,
mm-hmm.
sort of a thanks to the wives that come to the reunions, because they're coming and trying to understand us and what our experience was all about is very cathartic.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So.
Go ahead. I'm
not
sorry.
That they ever really can understand it, but they really make a good shot at it.
Right, right. Did the war affect your marriage?
You know, I don't think it did. I was divorced in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't really think that had anything to do with it.
Okay.
I think, if anything, I tend to think of myself all along as being a kind of a more on the compassionate side as a person.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that may have solidified it, going through the war and seeing what other people go through and
mm-hmm.
Being glad I don't have to walk in their shoes and I'm thankful for them.
Mm-hmm.
So it probably strengthened our marriage as much as anything.
Okay. Did you have difficulty transitioning to civilian life?
Only in the sense that I came from such a regimented background. Mm-hmm. Even though I went in civilian life, I went with South Central Bell, which is, being a big company, fairly regimented,
mm-hmm.
but nothing like military.
Right.
And, you know, I didn't know whether to call people Mr. or what to call them, mm-hmm. my coworkers, but I worked through that pretty quickly.
Okay, okay. Let's talk about your reflections on the war in general. Let's start with the United States policy in Vietnam. What did you think about that?
I think at the time I was too far removed from real policy,
mm-hmm.
other than the feeling that I really felt like they're doing something, the right thing,
mm-hmm.
and so I was very supportive of it. As I look back on it, I'm not sure that I could tell you whether going there was the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do, but I do think the cause was just,
mm-hmm.
and I guess the biggest problem that I've got is that after 10 years, we basically caught the last helicopter out of Saigon and left the Vietnamese on their own. We
right.
did our job, and that bothers me.
How did you feel in April 75 when Saigon fell? And
oh, man. Watching that on TV tore me up. I just said, I can't believe we're doing this.
Mm-hmm.
Not only that we've expended all we've expended over there, but we've left these people with not much hope.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's a bad feeling.
How about now? How do you feel about it?
Feel the same way.
Really?
Yeah, and when Florence and I went back, my second wife, mm-hmm. went back in 1995, we started in Hanoi and worked our way all the way through the country, spent about 18 days.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I wanted to do was find as many former enemy soldiers as I could and tell war stories.
Okay.
And what I found was that, number one, they're extraordinarily friendly, everybody,
mm-hmm.
from Hanoi all the way through the country. And
mm-hmm.
I think what their typical reaction was, and this kind of blew me away, when they saw a Caucasian, they thought they were either Russian or French, and they didn't like either one of them.
Mm-hmm.
But when they were found out you were an American,
mm-hmm.
total strangers, they'd invite you into their house, give you hot tea,
mm-hmm.
do all the stuff. And as I would talk to former enemy soldiers, they didn't mind talking about the war, but they really wanted to look to the future.
Mm-hmm.
And let's do a joint venture. Let's get this country going.
Mm-hmm.
And America still, 30 years later, we're still fighting Vietnam. They're
mm-hmm.
past it. They're just way past it. which I thought was interesting. The other thing that I would ask them, I said, why don't you have any animosity toward the Americans? I mean, mm-hmm. we tore your country up for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And to a man, they would say, we never had a problem with the American people. It was the American government we were fighting. Now, how they separated me shooting the bullets at them from that, I guess it's maybe the Oriental mindset.
Right. Right.
They have a much better attitude than we do. I'm not sure I answered your question.
No, you did. You answered a few questions I was going to ask you about your perception of the country today. And when I've traveled there, I've experienced the exact same thing.
Have you?
Actually, yeah, a future forward-looking people versus a reverse or backward-looking people.
You know, I found it very interesting how knowledgeable they are about our Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that I talked to would bring it up sometimes. I thought, how do you know about that?
Hmm.
And it occurred to me that their situation, not in the war, but after the war, was much like the Civil War in that in our Civil War, our technology far outpaced the tactics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were still walking four abreast into cannon, being cannon fodder.
Right.
And I think that their society, and you probably saw it too, is trying to get ahead of where they're able to be.
Mm-hmm.
It's outpacing them. And so they were struggling when I was there in 95 to try to figure that out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Capitalism reigned, even though it was still a communist country.
Right.
In fact, a funny thing, we went through the Ho Chi Minh Museum in Hanoi.
Mm-hmm.
And did you go through that?
Yes, sir.
By chance?
Yes, sir.
Two things that struck me. One was, if you recall, they had several rooms or areas set up for all the various wars that they've been in.
Yes.
And the one for the American War was not very big.
It mm-hmm.
was kind of a blip on the radar screen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The other thing was their room that had the contrasting capitalism and communism, and they had two symbols. I don't recall what the communist symbol was, but the capitalist symbol was a mock-up of an Edsel. So weird. Where'd they get an Edsel?
Vietnamese are industrious people. Tell me what your thoughts were on the media coverage of the war overall, looking back at it now.
I've got quite a different view looking back. In fact, I'm still not a big Peter Arnett fan, but I understand him much more now. He has a book called, I can't remember it, but it's about his combat experiences
mm-hmm.
that has given me a much different view. When I was in country, I really saw the media as a pain in the neck that mm-hmm. basically gave information to the enemy, and they weren't on our side. I mean, that was my whole total focus.
Mm-hmm.
As I look on it now, I see that they have a much more in terms of the information they put out.
I'm sorry, you cut out again.
It's going to beep again. Hang on just a second.
That's okay.
You know, I see now that the media has a role beyond just supporting the country, and that mm-hmm. is reporting what's going on the ground. And so my viewpoint now, while I still feel a little of that frustration to sort of fly in, mm-hmm. get a good story and beat it, I'm much more sympathetic, I think, to what they do and how they do it.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. I find, too, the embedded journalism thing in Iraq has been very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think that's tainted them somewhat, maybe in some cases because they get awfully close to the troops.
Right.
But,
right. Yeah. What are your thoughts today on the anti-war movement, looking back?
On Vietnam?
Yes, sir.
You know, I go back to that thought that I don't know if it was our job to be in Vietnam or not, but once we were there, I think the cause was just. And I guess the anti-war movement, well, clearly it got us out earlier. I'm afraid it also hamstrung us in terms of getting the job done.
Mm-hmm.
And they may have had some measure of control over the fact that we didn't do the job over there, what we were called to do, and we lost an awful lot of American lives
mm-hmm.
for really not much.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, since I was the guy getting shot at while they were burning the flag, it irritated me. But on the other hand, I think the overriding thing is that's why soldiers go to fight, is so that some other guy can burn the flag mm-hmm. in downtown Birmingham, if that's
mm-hmm.
what they want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes our country great.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Have you suffered any PTSD incidents that you're aware of?
Personally, no, not that I know of.
Okay.
I do. Every now and then, very infrequently, I'll have a dream where I'm running.
Mm-hmm.
And there are NVA involved, and for some reason I can't run fast enough, and I don't ever know what happens. The dream never ends.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's not a bad dream, necessarily. It's just
right.
kind of a weird dream.
Right. You said you've read a lot of books on Vietnam.
Yeah.
Any of them stand out in your mind?
Into Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I like that one because the 11th Cav spearheaded the assault.
Yes, sir.
The thing that frustrates me maybe is that there are an awful lot of books written on infantry, LERPs, SEALs, Rangers, Air Force, but almost nothing on cavalry and armor.
Mm-hmm.
So there's not much to relate to there, though there are a couple of them. And I'm terrible at remembering the names of books.
Mm-hmm.
Field of Fire
mm-hmm.
was a good one. But I've got bookshelves full of them.
Okay, so you've done a lot of reading on that.
Yeah.
Okay, how about movies on Vietnam?
The first one I saw was Platoon.
Mm-hmm.
And my impression was, you know, it starts out with that guy sitting on an ambush in his poncho and the
mm-hmm.
rain pouring down on him. And
mm-hmm.
I thought, man, that is Vietnam. Other than the kind of what seemed to me unrealistic personality issues that were in the movie, I thought that the combat scenes and that kind of stuff were pretty real.
Mm-hmm.
I watched Full Metal Jacket, and that to me was so kind of off the wall, I finally stopped watching it midway
mm-hmm.
through.
Mm-hmm.
Apocalypse Now was so far off the wall, I could barely get into that one.
Mm-hmm.
And other than that, I haven't really watched too many Vietnam movies.
Do you try to avoid them? Or?
No. I'm just not much of a movie person.
Okay.
I did say I've got a good friend who was in the Battle of the Idrang Valley, and
mm-hmm.
I went to see We Were Soldiers,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was good.
Okay. Did you go see it with him?
No, I went with a bunch of guys from my Sunday school class.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, actually, I did go with him. And then we went to a barbecue place afterwards and let him tell the real deal.
Oh, yeah?
Which was really interesting.
I bet so.
To hear his point of view.
I bet so.
Yeah.
How do you feel about your service in Vietnam today, looking back at it?
In what way?
Well, just in general. What are your thoughts about it?
As I look at it from a personal standpoint,
mm-hmm.
I feel pride's the wrong word. Thankful that I was able to go and do what I think my job was, do it to the best of my ability.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely see myself as having come out a better person for it.
Mm-hmm. In what ways?
Stronger mentally. Knowing that I can do things physically that I didn't think I could do before. Understanding that other people have it a lot worse than you do.
Mm-hmm.
Being part of that camaraderie of combat soldiers
mm-hmm.
Is pretty amazing. Even, you know, today, Vietnam vets who don't even know each other, you just got a brotherhood
mm-hmm.
that I don't know how I could possibly describe it. But, I have a Black Horse patch on the back of my car,
mm-hmm.
partly to show off, I guess, but partly to be a flag to any other Black Horse veterans who are out there. And
mm-hmm.
my wife and I several years ago were in a little mountainous area in Alabama,
mm-hmm.
going up this windy mountain road, and there was a sort of a panel truck behind me.
Mm-hmm.
Guy got right up on my tail, and he was blowing the horn. I thought, man, this reminds me of Deliverance or something. So I kept going, didn't pay attention to him. He kept blowing the horn. Finally, we got to the top of the mountain, and I said, I got to let him by. I pulled off to the side of the road. He pulled up next to me. I thought, uh-oh.
Mm-hmm.
Turned out to be another 11th Cav guy.
Really?
Yeah, so out in the middle of nowhere, we, you know, hug and do
uh-huh.
all the stuff.
Uh-huh. Is there anything that you would change about your Vietnam experience if you could?
Nope.
Nothing at all?
No.
Okay. How do you feel like the war itself, in general, has most affected your life? You just described some of the character traits you took away from it and things you learned, but in general, how has it most affected you?
If I look at it from a broader perspective, I think Vietnam gave our whole country a different perspective on what we're all about
mm-hmm.
as a country. And how we ought to go about it, not only in terms of when we go to war, you know, to go to war to do war,
mm-hmm.
But also whether we ought to be there or not,
mm-hmm.
To be more thoughtful about when we get into it. Whether, I don't know how thoughtful we were on Iraq. I can't call that one, but,
mm-hmm.
but again, I think we certainly did a good deed over there.
What lessons do you think the United States took from Vietnam?
From the military standpoint, I think a lesson of commitment. Total commitment to your cause.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of fought a war of attrition in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Only put the same pressure on them that they're putting on you. And that's no way to fight a war.
Mm-hmm.
And again, certainly, if you're going to get involved in it to accomplish your mission. Not that we always have. You know,
mm-hmm.
certainly Mogadishu is a good example of that. But,
mm-hmm.
but at least go into that mindset.
Okay. If you walked into a classroom today of young people, high school age, junior high, college, what would you tell them about Vietnam?
That, in fact, is something I love to do. In fact, I do it occasionally at Sanford, mm-hmm. in a Vietnam class there, and do it to youth groups and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
The two things I do, and depending on the group, depending on whether it's a Christian group or not a Christian group, the message is a little different.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that I do is share my experience, share why I thought we were there, what we were trying to accomplish, and, again, whether we were right or wrong being there, that I thought the cause was just.
Mm-hmm.
But the final message that I give them are, if it's a non-Christian group, it's twofold. One part of the message is that war is not everything it's cracked up to be, and I relate to them the picture you've seen of the wall with the skull on it.
Mm-hmm.
War isn't really what it's not the glamorous thing we think it is. The other thing that I relate to them is that there are an awful lot of people who have sacrificed an awful lot so that I personally can enjoy the freedoms that we have in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's what America's all about. It takes a lot of sacrifice to do that, to have what we've got.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what Vietnam says to me.
What do you tell Christian groups that's different from that?
The third thing that I add relates specifically to John Brady, who was the guy whose name was on the wall,
yes, sir,
that the skull was over superimposed on. And I make the comment, I don't know if Brady was a Christian then or not when he died, but based on my understanding, if he wasn't a Christian then, he'll never have another opportunity. So you shouldn't wait till it's too late to make your commitment.
Okay. And we should note for the record that this photo that you took of the wall we have here in your collection at the Vietnam Archive. And so if people are interested, they can view this online.
Yeah.
At some point, they will be able to do that. And
great.
Actually, it will be here physically in your collection.
Uh-huh.
Let me ask you about what you think the myths or the misconceptions about the Vietnam veteran or the Vietnam soldier, the American Vietnam soldier, is in this country.
I think one of the big ones is that Vietnam veterans are a bunch of drugged out addicts that ride motorcycles,
mm-hmm.
And have long hair, and some of them do, and that's fine. But I don't think that's the typical, and certainly even the ones that have long hair and ride motorcycles, a lot of them are great guys.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that maybe the media through movies has sort of portrayed that, because an awful lot of the movies tend to focus on that drug culture aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the myth I'd like to see go away the most,
mm-hmm.
I guess.
Okay. Do you think the U.S. government's taking care of its Vietnam veterans?
Yeah, you really hear a lot of controversy, and I can only speak to my personal experience and the experience of those that I know. In my case, I couldn't have imagined that it would have been any better. I know Gary Pinion, the guy that had his face blown off. I had an interesting reunion with him just a few years ago. In fact, if you don't mind, can I share that with you?
Absolutely, absolutely.
When he was hit, my platoon medic gave him an emergency tracheotomy and put him back together as best he could, and I called for a dust off.
Mm-hmm.
And it literally, it peeled his face off. He had shrapnel all over him.
Mm-hmm.
And dust off came, we loaded him on board, and, mm-hmm. and he was gone. And as often, I say often, sometimes over there, you never knew what happened to the guys that were medevac. You
mm-hmm.
just never heard, you know,
mm-hmm.
what happened to him. And that was the case with Gary. We didn't know if he lived or died or what happened to him. I was really afraid, given the severity of his wounds, that he probably wouldn't even make the helicopter ride to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
But over the years, I thought about him, and I thought, you know, that if by any miracle he were still alive, I would love to talk to him again. But I didn't have a very good way of tracking him down until about 2.5 years ago. I thought, well, I'm going to do a people search on the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
I knew he's from Ohio, so I started my search there. And I found a Gary Pinion in Akron.
Mm-hmm.
So I jotted down the phone number and picked up the phone and dialed it. Phone rang a couple times, and I really kind of hoped nobody would answer because I didn't have a clue what I was going to say.
Mm-hmm.
And on the fourth ring, this voice answers and says, hello. I said, is this Gary Pinion? And the voice said, yes, it is. I said, are you the Gary Pinion who served in Vietnam? And the voice said, yes, I am. And I said, Gary, I don't know if you'll remember me, but my name's Ty Dodge, and I think I was your platoon leader.
Mm-hmm.
And with no hesitation, he said, I remember you, LT.
Huh.
And, you know, I can't even begin to describe the flood of emotions that drained out of me over the next hour as we reunited after more than 30 years.
Mm.
I know for me it wrapped up a loose end, one of those combat veteran emotional loose ends.
Mm-hmm.
I think it wrapped up a loose end for Gary, too, because the force of the blast that day left him with no memory of what happened.
And
the
really?
Medical staff at the first hospital that he got to, they didn't know what happened either, nor did the ones at the next hospital or the next. I mean, he's been going to hospitals for 25 years,
mm-hmm.
putting his body and his life back together. Nobody knew what happened.
Hmm.
And so I was able to tell him the rest of the story. And the thing that I find interesting about him, he's blind and disabled now.
He is?
Yeah, lives by himself,
uh-huh.
not too far from his mom and a daughter and several grandkids.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing that struck me about him was that he had a voice just filled with love and hope.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking about the hope issue, he called me about two summers ago, and he said, Ty, I just fulfilled a dream. I said, really, what'd you do? He said, I bought something I wanted all my adult life. I said, that's cool. What'd you buy? He said, I bought myself a brand new black Corvette. I thought, man, Penny, you're blind. He doesn't drive it, but he sure would like to ride around in it.
That's great.
So I still hadn't met him at that point.
Uh-huh.
And so I talked him into going to an 11th Cav reunion last August.
Uh-huh.
And in fact, it was interesting. We have a patriotic rally at my church every year, which was in July.
Mm-hmm.
And I was asked to do a testimony, and so I told about Gary Pinion, and I asked if they would pray for my reunion with Gary.
Mm-hmm.
So Florence and I went to the reunion and met with Gary, and Gary and I had a couple of hours, just the two of us, to talk over old times, look mm-hmm. to the future and what have you. And he said something that was so poignant to me. About midway through our conversation, he turned to me and he said, Ty, there's something I've got to know. He said, it's been eating me up for more than 30 years, and I know what you tell me might be painful, but I've got to know the answer.
Mm-hmm.
I said, sure, Gary, what is it? He said, what did I do wrong, and how many other guys were hurt?
Mm.
Oh, man, all I could do is just throw a big bear hug on the guy and say, mm-hmm. Gary, because you did everything right, nobody else was hurt.
But mm-hmm.
having that reunion and seeing a guy that's gone through what he's gone through
mm-hmm.
makes my life look pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty good.
Yes, sir. Can you tell me about your experiences at the wall in Washington?
Yeah, I think one thing that stands out to me is that, I guess it's the most visited monument in Washington.
Yes, sir.
Is that so many of the people who really haven't, many of them have no direct connection. They were not born when the war was going on or whatever. Just that sense of reverence that people have.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first thing that struck me. I tend to feel the same thing, when I see names of guys that I knew,
mm-hmm.
What their lives could have been.
Mm-hmm.
And I've only been maybe four times, something like that, four or five times. I think the time that I took the picture was maybe my second or third time,
mm-hmm.
something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been a good experience for me.
Do you think back to your time when you're there, or do you think to the future? How do you feel?
I tend to think back to the past, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Which I think in a way is a little self-serving, and I say that in this way. Vietnam, I think for the guys that were there or who are in any combat situation, is a pretty incredible experience that other people really can't understand.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe we find some of our significance by looking back
mm-hmm.
and being with other people who can understand, and I mean being at the wall with some of those is one of those experiences that affirms the significance of what we've done.
Mm-hmm. Do you talk to other veterans when you're there, or have you?
Oddly enough, I don't think I ever have.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm usually there with family, and so we talk.
Right, right. How does your family feel about your experience in Vietnam?
Interesting. The wife to whom I'm married now has been great about listening to my Black Horse stories and then going back to Vietnam with me to try to kind of capture that experience so
mm-hmm.
she can understand it better. She's, very supportive of that.
Mm-hmm.
The only living close relative that I have now is my sister, and she and her husband are retired military, so they've kind of been through that same deal, and they're very supportive.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, positive all the way around.
Okay. Have you had any contact with Vietnamese here in the United States?
A few. One that I found when Florence and I came back from Vietnam, I had a few Vietnamese phrases and things that I couldn't translate.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out that there was a young Vietnamese guy in our church, and so I went to him, and he said, I can't do it. although he was born there and came. I'm beeping through. Let me beep through again.
Okay.
Anyway, he was born there but really never knew the country. And
mm-hmm.
he said, but my dad can translate it. So he took this stuff to his dad.
Mm-hmm.
So I've had that experience here.
Okay.
I had one about a month ago when I was driving by Lubbock.
Mm-hmm.
We'd gotten up to Colorado. We were in the Black Canyon
mm-hmm.
at Gunnison. And standing there overlooking the canyon, and two young guys who were obviously in school out there came up. One was Vietnamese and asked if they could take our picture. So I struck up a conversation with him.
Mm-hmm.
But really haven't had much Vietnamese contact other than that. Now, my sister, who lives in the Washington area,
mm-hmm.
they do a ton of Vietnamese stuff, primarily through their church, but
mm-hmm.
primarily to boat people, and I guess they're not boat people anymore, but
right.
a lot of that population that lives in the Washington area,
right.
helping them out.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Mr. Dodge, is there anything else that you'd like to talk about today or discuss that we have not covered?
Let me see. Covered a lot of stuff. I will have to say that it is being able to do something like this is a cathartic experience for me.
Yes, sir.
Just to be able to share with obviously somebody who's pretty deeply involved in it like you are.
Yes, sir.
I think that's good for vets, and I think having a resource like yours at Texas Tech, maybe it'll help us keep from repeating some of the mistakes that we've made in the past.
Yes, sir.
I always think that the experience of the French in Vietnam should have kept us from repeating some of those mistakes, but it didn't do a very good job.
Yes, sir.
Well, I think pretty much we've covered the waterfront.
Okay. Well, very good. We'll go ahead and officially end the interview with Ty Dodge. Thank you very much, sir, for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate it.